go.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! I am indeed here behind the microphone and the mixer. I am back. I am where I belong. I am back in the hills. I am tired. Guy James is probably something on the order of dead on his feet, exhausted. We shared a room in D.C. and got up this morning at about 5:15. Guy had an 8 o'clock flight to catch out of National Airport. My Goonie Bird didn't leave the ground until about 12:30, so I got leaving nothing to chance. I schlepped my bulk to the metro station and got out to Dulles with about 3 hours remaining. And I'm going to try to go through this linearly, because I've been gone since Tuesday morning. But please bear with me, because sometimes I don't do linear too well. I looked around the room at the assembled bloggers and the radio folks who were there at the Progressive Media Summit. It was a wonderful, wonderful gathering. And really, considering the distance that's been traveled, and this was the third one in 3 short years, it was quite impressive, really. But I looked around at those, let's deal with some things. Don't kid yourself. Nobody there knew me from Adam's house cat. With the exception of Guy James and Mark Levine. But that wasn't the point. I started looking around and trying to figure out what, and this is not some egomaniacal moment or anything, but why it is that. I felt sort of different in the room. I think it probably had to do with my swelling feet. The fact of the matter is, I'm a pretty robust guy, and I can get around pretty good. And I did. The Guy James and I both did some hiking. But you know what? If I had a second pair of dress shoes, I would be having some sort of midnight black mass over my Florsheim dress shoes this evening and burn them till they were ashes. Oh God, they have they're traditional lace up kind of Oxford affairs, and they're lace up. And if nothing else, I would think air travel would have just about all but eliminated the lace up shoe. Because after all, there's the whole removing of the shoes ritual, you know, and at the airport at security, and it doesn't have nearly the charm of say, you know, entering the home before the exquisite Japanese tea ceremony or anything like that, by no stretch of the imagination. So, but anyway, it might have had something to do with my feet, but it also has to do with the way that I acknowledge that I look at the world. Because way, way, way back when, I think I may have mentioned it on the show, but I realized that my son brought me a poem a month or so back, and it was a beautiful thing. And it reminded me that I had written my first poem at his age, too, on a topic similar. He's writing about the land where he lives, and I was writing about the woods where I grew up and how they were being taken down to put in an apartment complex. I guess it was maybe a tenth the size of Christopher Robin's 40-acre wood, because it wasn't near that. But I hated it, and Ferg hates what's going on in his world. But I can't look at things in a linear fashion. I see things with a poet's eye, and whether I'm any good as a poet is not an issue here. I'm as much of a generalist as I am at anything else. Everything I saw, I looked at with a poet's eye and with an eye toward images and with an eye toward meanings that were either higher or deeper, broader, or running just below the surface, like those still waters that run deep. I left here on Tuesday. Sing me, O Muse. Call me Ishmael. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. I left here on Tuesday amid flurrying snow, listening to the inaugural proceedings on the radio. I'm a radio guy, you know. I like the visions I get in my head a hell of a lot better than the visions that the electric TV box, the sacred secular altar hands me. I just do. I like still photography better than I like video. And I like audio better than I do. You get the idea. So I'm cruising down the road watching the snow fly. And I'm not afraid of flying. But I am an uneasy flyer. Just because, I guess I don't do it enough to get really comfortable with the process. Oh, yeah, I'm home. I'm home, and I haven't even unpacked. I'm dead on my feet, and you guys are taunting me with the Guinness icon in the chat room. Thanks a million, folks. I need some kickback about now, but that won't happen for a few more hours, and I can hold off. But anyway, going down the road and listening to the radio and seeing the snow fly, I looked over to Agnes and I said, you know, aircraft and snowfall don't mix. I said, I guess I'm just morose, but I can't help thinking about Richie Valens, Buddy Holly, and the Big Bopper. And she said, oh, just stop it, Bob. Just stop it. Will you quit? So then, a little bit later, the cell phone rings, and it's Guy calling from D.C. to tell me what a zoo he's in the middle of. And I tell him what the conditions are, and you know what the first words out of Guy James's mouth are? That's right. The Big Bopper, Buddy Holly, and Richie Valens. Thanks, Guy. But no, I got there okay. It was not nearly the horrifying ride that the Dulles to Charleston trip was last February. Although this story may take 3 hours in the telling just because there's so much of it and so many, again, little images that impressed themselves upon me. I got to Beckley International Airport. Yeah, the international part. It really is a fine little airport. A beautiful little structure. It's sort of reminiscent of the curved wing shape of the main terminal at Dulles. Only being a West Virginia airport, ours is made out of pickled pine or knotty pine or something like that instead of whatever it is Dulles is made out of, which I assume to be concrete and aluminum or steel or rebar. I don't know. And so I get there and go through the ritual, the disrobing ritual. And I was traveling in a suit because, you know, you don't just want to pop into the middle of the aftermath of somebody's inauguration wearing your I'm with stupid T-shirts and a pair of ratty ass jeans. Especially not with it, you know, wind chill -5, which it was. So it's off with the trench coat. It's off with the suit jacket. It's off with the shoes. Do you have any gel or liquid materials? And I know there's a lot of people that go through this, but I don't go through it very often. And I was just sitting there wholly impressed by the inane stupidity of it. By this manifestation of that which you know I've come to refer to as our status as the coward nation. COWERED, coward. For any right wingers, say, he called us cowards! No, we are the coward nation, COWERED. So I went through all of that, and we got on the plane, all four of us. Yeah, there were four people on the United is not making any big any money. They're losing money. They're not making any money at all on the Beckley to D.C. run. And, you know, it's subsidized. The United gets a little corporate welfare for that. And you know what? I don't object to United getting a little corporate welfare for that. I wish we would re-regulate the airlines so that maybe, we're at a point now where we can start having a serious conversation about how far back we have to look to start fixing America. It was the Jimmy Carter administration from January 20th, 1977 to January the 20th, 1981 that was the last time the American demographic was American families were made up by a single wage earner household. That's the last time that an American family was able to reasonably, in the majority, get by on one wage earner. This is in no wise a comment on women who want to work or women who go to work. Everybody has to work now because we are living in Barack Obama's been inaugurated. He is the president of the United States. But we, by God, are indeed still in the middle of the right-wing Republican capitalist miracle where everybody goes to work for as long as the predators allow that to happen. And then when they wind up ripping everybody off and they go crash and boom, too, the working people are just cast to the wayside like so much garbage. See, I told you I was going to have a hard time doing this linearly. So anyway, we get out and get on the plane, and there's me and there's a lady, there's a guy who flies for another company, there's me and one other person. We all have to go to the back of the airplane. There was nothing prejudiced about it. Apparently, that little sob story of an airplane, SAAB sob, won't get off the ground if there's anybody sitting in the front. It's a balance issue. So it's the first time I've been on an aircraft since almost a year before. I'm doing okay. I'm all right. I'm a big boy. I'm all grown up. I understand the principles and the flight dynamics and everything that holds that thing up against the theory of gravity. Remember, it is a theory. Just ask Gary Chisholm in the right-wing Republican lunatic legislator from the state of Mississippi. Gravity is only a theory, and airplanes confirm that it's only a theory. So I understand. So I'm not sitting there shaking or turning white or, you know, whiter. Or grabbing the chair armrests with my knuckles, just, you know, and my thumbnails just digging into the foam padding of the armrests or anything. No, I'm not like that. So you know, the captain comes on the inaudible sound system, which is, you know, there's another question. Why can't they make an audible sound, something where you can understand the words? He was speaking English, but you wouldn't have known it. But I did pick up about this much in between the crackles and the static.
We're leaving New York. The terminal in Beckley. Airport.
Okay, so 55-minute ride. Cool. Takes me longer than that to drive down the mountain to Charleston. So, zim, 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 go the propellers. And we go toddling out to the tarmac, off the tarmac, out to the runway. And you know how it is. You get out there at idle, and then all of a sudden the Captain Roger Ramjet, you know, puts full power and the lights dim, and you know, off you go. Well, all that happened except the off you go part. The off-you-go part didn't happen. We just sat there gunning our engines. All of a sudden, wait a minute. What, is there an ice storm up there? What? And we sat on the tarmac gunning our engines for 28 minutes. Now, this was a flight that was supposed to leave at 3. We got off the ground at 3:30. And I'm sitting there going, what the hell? Wait a minute. We're just sitting. I mean, it's not like the Beckley International has a hell of a lot of aircraft circling it, you know, waiting to be brought in, you know, in some sort of a parking orbit to get down to the. No. So we're up and we're gone. And then we flew around the entire southeastern United States. I felt like Alan Arkin in one of my favorite comedies, The In-Laws, where he looks at Peter Falk and looks down and they're in a small aircraft much similar to the one I was in. And Alan Arkin, the mild-mannered dentist who didn't want to be in on all of this, looks at Peter Falk, the CIA agent that he doesn't know is a CIA agent, and he says, "The ocean? It's over the ocean to Scranton, Pennsylvania?" Well, that's where what I had going on. Because I know my topography fairly well, and anybody who's paying attention on a clear day, and we were above the deck, I mean, I could see the sun. I had the sun on every quadrant of the aircraft four or five times during the flight. I saw the James River Basin, okay? I think we were halfway to Charlotte at one point. And then we were way the hell out over the Pennsylvania or Ohio or maybe over New York. They're just looping and turning. And so then we do get stuck in some sort of a parking pattern over Dulles as they slowly let people in and out, and lots of corporate jets and private jets, and you know us commercial schlubs flying standard economy. Well, you know, we're in steerage on the Titanic as far as the tower at Dulles is concerned. So we finally get on the ground, and in the meantime, this something's been going on in my head because I did kind of look down, check the watch, see what time it is. And pieces start falling into place. And I'm sitting there muttering under my breath like some like your crazy old uncle on Thanksgiving Day after he's been into the eggnog a little too long. Just like stagging, not snagging, nursing. And on the way out, I just looked up to the crew in the cockpit of the plane. And I said, "Guys, tell me we didn't just do all of that for George W. Bush." And the pilot, apparently of a decent sense of humor, looks back and says, "Okay, I'll tell you we didn't, but we did." I said, "The 28 minutes on the time." He said, "Yeah, waiting for him to clear our airspace." And I said, "Son of a..." One last thumb in my eye. One last thumb in my eye from George W. Bush. And yeah, it does feel personal. It's felt personal since January the 20th, 2001. And I'm reminded of our good friend Reverbo, who uses that line from the book he mentioned to us long ago. Make it personal. It was personal. This was one last little stream of pee on my shoes from George W. Bush, the most terrified man ever to occupy the office of President of the United States. One last time I was inconvenienced. I was put out because of that hateful, miserable, little, jug-eared, pig-eyed little lout as he slimed and sleazed his way out of Washington, D.C. for what I hope will be the last time for a very, very, very long time. So we finally get on the ground at Dulles. And I have never been on the Washington metro system. I am a hillbilly. I am country mouse coming to the city, okay? I am. Yeah, I know, New Yorkers, Angelenos, Chicagoans. Hey, Bob, D.C.'s not a city. It's a little town. No, you don't come from Fayetteville, okay? And I'm not talking about the big Fayetteville, the one in Arkansas. I'm talking about Fayetteville where I live in West Virginia. So, already, I can feel my heartbeat in my feet from these damn dress shoes. If the Transportation Security Administration had wanted to take away my dress shoes, I think I would have tipped them, but for how cold it was. So then it's the bus out to a metro stop, and then onto the metro train, which I then got shunted onto the wrong one of. Thank you very much. Look, I am who I am. All right, I travel well. I'm not a complainer. But this is the story of what happened. And by then it's probably 5:30. And I'm in very good spirits. Very, very good spirits. Taking it all in. Using that poet's eyeball to look at the whole situation, that sucking it all, just drinking it in so that I can come back and tell you and tell my family. And so I get on the wrong train, and I realize I'm on the wrong train when I start hearing the wrong names come out, like, you know, Foggy Bottom and Pentagon City and Crystal City and all off for Reagan National Airport. And that, too, feels like another personal little moment because I had sworn I would never set, you know, I would fly into Dulles. I would avoid National Airport just to say that I had never had anything to do with anything named after that greasy-headed old freak who screwed up my early adult life. But no, there I am. But along the way, it was worth the trip. Because along the way, I saw the great huddled mass of humanity heading home from what had to be, for them, a momentous occasion. These weren't people with pink tickets or yellow tickets or purple tickets or silver tickets. These weren't people with any tickets. These were people who had made their way to the heart of our republic's capital so that they could say to another generation sometime down the road, I was there. I was there. By God, I saw it happen. I saw history made. I saw America turn a corner that has been centuries in the turning. I was there. I saw smiling people of every race, every nationality. If in fact there is any truth at all to the fairy tale contained in Genesis about the Tower of Babel and what happened the day after the Lord God confused their speech, then I know what it sounded like around the tower. Because every ethnicity, every nationality, every tongue, it seemed, was represented. And I just continued to drink it all in. I saw, and bear in mind, everyone was smiling. Everyone had an ecstatic grin on their face, knowing what they had witnessed. None of them were going to any balls. None of them were going to any fancy dress parties. None of them were going to be eating very small food with expensive ingredients. Some may have been going home to no food at all. This is, after all, still, because it's only started to be fixed. This is still Bushmerica. I saw a woman sitting on the train, and she had two children who I would guess were maybe 6 and 4 or 3 and 5, bundled up like just like little cocoon people in her arms, and one resting on each arm, one her head resting against the window glass of the train, and the other on the other side, with his head leaning on his mommy's shoulder. And those little ones were asleep. And they were sleeping a blissful sleep. And they both had Christmas faces on. They were asleep and they were smiling like sunshine in the middle of the dark. They were lit up with joy. And they were absolute magnets for everybody on the train who just kept looking at them. And I mean, the train was packed by this point. Hanging on the center tubes, the little hang-on-y thingies. And people in every seat. And it, honest to God, it brought a tear to my eye to see those little children. Because their mama and their daddy will reinforce to them, baby, you were there. You were there. We made sure you were there. And this is America again. And I remember when that hateful old goon ray gun had that ad that prattled on about it being morning in America. Morning in America dawned on January the 20th, 2009. Make no mistake. So I didn't see any of the inaugural festivities. There was no chance of me ever seeing them in the first place, because even had everything been on schedule, I wouldn't have seen them. But I saw something far more important to me. I saw American people. I saw people of numerous nationalities. Working people. The people who get up day in and day out and do it again, amen, and make this country go. And I saw them suffused with hope and purpose and happiness. And I was proud, frankly, I was proud to be on that train, because I said I saw them, I saw us, I saw we. Because I'm not part of the small food-eating, ball-going crowd. Not at all. Those were my folks. And I was proud to be among them. So I realized my error at National Airport. Forgo the hateful name they prefixed upon it. And I got back on the yellow line, because I was getting off the blue. Got back on the yellow line, rode away from National, crossed the river into D.C., and in so doing, we began to pick up the party crowd. I saw one woman of a certain age with a pair of pumps on that were strapped to, and because I guess I was foot focused because mine were in hell. I felt like I just had someone giving me the permanent little broken matchstick hot foot. But I saw one woman who I knew that would wind up in much more intense discomfort than I, because she was on her way to the party, and her feet were already just sort of trying to explode or escape from the little straps going across the top of her instep. You ain't dancing the night away on those, honey. But you try. And the tuxedo crowd got on. And the people, they're talking like this, you know, less the hoi polloi here. And pretty soon, the car was full of those folks. And I finally made my way to Union Station. My grail. Because I was going to meet Guy at a hotel near there where Radio Row had been taking place. Cell phone communication had dropped to nil. It wouldn't connect. It was a totally overloaded wireless infrastructure. And then I got to the place where you ride the escalators up to the top of Union Station. And suddenly I see all these guys walking around with serious sidearms and firearms and riot vests and the old German-style coal scuttle helmets, you know, our guys, and started listening to the crowd, and heard, and apparently there had been some sort of a bomb threat inside Union Station. Dutifully non-reported. So couldn't go up, and they weren't sure whether they were going to let us out of the building that had had the bomb threat in it, so we were told. And eventually they did and walked down and out and up the little hill there to Capitol Hill. And what I beheld at that point was almost indescribable, except to say that back in my misspent youth, from time to time, and I was a member of a fraternity in college, and I would have to be away from the house on a night when the chapter was throwing a party of some sort. By the way, my fraternity no longer does that thing. Those things, we have a complete no alcohol in the house policy. You know, gone are the days of Delta House from from Animal House. No hazing, no booze. That's all gone, largely, so I'm told. But it looked like what would happen when I would have to be away at a rehearsal or a reading or some such or a lecture and come back after the party, and there would be empty kegs all over the place and paper cups all over the floor and just general mayhem and chaos, total mess, and you just look around and go, how are we ever going to get this cleaned up? Well, that was Washington, D.C. at about 7:30 p.m., on January the 20th, 2009. Everything was bathed in bright the Klieg lights, and you could hear the persistent humming of generators. And everything was blockaded. Traffic was hopelessly snarled. And it was freezing. God, it was cold. So I've got my computer backpack on my back, which also had my still camera and the video camera in it. And I'm carrying my suit bag, which has two suits and shaving kits and stuff. And even though it's made of like ballistic nylon, is apparently the heaviest suit bag ever manufactured, short of the use of iron. And I, apart from knowing that I'm at Union Station, I'm lost because I don't know where the hotel is that guy is at. And so, being an intrepid soul, start walking. You'll figure it out when you get there. And this is one of those moments that just, I don't know. I think if Sister Kate was listening this evening, she would know what I'm getting at. This is one of those little moments that the universe hands you. One of those moments where you find out kind of how you stand in the order of things in the universe. Not in the grand pecking order of who's got the bigger bank account. I guess I'm trying to make it seem like some sort of omen or tiding. And for a guy who tries to live rationally, that's sort of like I need to be taken out and re-educated or something. But the traffic was a mess, and you could stand there with your hand out for a cab all day long and all night and freeze that way. You wasn't getting a cab. So a guy comes up to me, says, "Boss, I'll get you a cab." I didn't have a tux on or anything, but I had suit and tie and a trench coat, and I could. He was wearing an old army fatigue coat with a hood pulled up, the hood of a hoodie underneath the coat, and a beard going for him. You probably know, you've probably got a pretty good mental image of what this man looked like. Friendly as all get out. And I said, "No, I don't think I'm going to get a cab." He said, "Where are you going?" And I told him, Liaison Hotel. He says, "Across from the Hyatt Regency?" I said, "That's what I'm told." He says, "Come on, I'll walk you." And you know what? It's what we did. And it wasn't very far. And we've taken a few steps along. I'm just following along, ambling beside him. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he looks at me and says, Now, white man, don't be afraid, because I am a homeless person. I'm like, huh? It wasn't like I hadn't figured it out, but it happens to people. He says, you're going to be all right. Because I don't know, I guess a white guy who, is that what D.C., is that what city living's like, that the white people of white privilege who come into contact with people who have probably suffered a lot more hell in their lives than any of us will ever dream about, who happens to be of color, that there's this automatic, you know, whoa, what? Because I don't think I was giving any of that off. I was just happy to be having somebody who knew where they were going taking me there, on foot, in a car, in a plane, on a train, in a box with a fox, on a boat by a moat. I just wanted to get somewhere the heat was on. See how I am? He says, yeah, I'm a homeless man. I'm a homeless person. I said, well, how'd you come to be homeless? He said, I will tell you the truth. Ain't anybody in this, any other city homeless, but for three reasons. Woman troubles, drug and alcohol troubles, or mental illness. And he said, I'll be straight with you. I got all three. He said, but back behind where we're going, there's a little building there. I mean, there's a little space out of the window, and that's where I sleep at night. And they got a plug in back there, and I got a little portable heater I can plug in, and I can huddle up against it when I sleep. And my poor brain was on overload. I said, any chance of life getting better for you? He said, not right now, but it might. Never know, it might. How's that for optimism on Inauguration Tuesday, January the 20th, 2009? Not right now, but it might. Is America getting any better here 2 days into the Obama administration? Not right now, but it might. So he walks me around the corner and he said, there you go. Just go right in the door there. Sure they'll be happy to see you. And I reached in my pocket, took out what I could, handed it to him, and said, you do the best thing in the world you can do for yourself with that. You take care of yourself now. He said, oh, I will. You take care of yourself too. And he walked away into the night. And I walked into the hotel, at which point, I said, I guess to the universe, just a little thank you. For that guy. I don't know that I made his life any better, but he made mine a hell of a lot better. He wasn't getting out of the cold, but he got me out of the cold a lot faster than I otherwise would have. And he gave me a little glimpse of an America that I don't see very often, because here in the hills and hollers, we got poor and we got homeless. But we don't have poor and homeless like American cities have poor and homeless. No, no. So I was just sort of gobsmacked or blinded or stunned or shook or whatever by what I had just been through. And I'll be honest with you. I'll be candid. You know, I mean, you know, I don't have 3 hours a night to pull your leg. I can't look at a human being like that and not see myself. I cannot look at a human being in desperate circumstances and not see one of mine and one that I love. And frankly, you know, I've told you 1,000 times that I'm a recovering Southern Baptist, and this is part of that. This is why we use the participial form and not the past or past perfect tense. I'm a recovering Southern Baptist. Because all in the world I heard, that still and small and tiny voice in the back of my mind and in the dimmest corners of my soul, such as it is, or may not be, was one of those little old blue-haired ladies in the basement of the Baptist church. Reading that verse, those verses. I was hungry, and ye fed me not. I was naked, and ye clothed me not. And if you've done it unto the least of these, done it also unto me. Well, this is not the sermonette portion. But that's always back there. And all I can do is hope that that man gets, and perhaps I sound naive or simple or somebody can drive you, Bob, you son of privilege, you. Maybe so. But I tell you truly, everything that happened from then on was viewed through the lens that that gentleman, and I use the term specifically, that that gentleman put before my eyes. And the lens that those two sleeping children with the smiles on their faces put before my eyes. I finally walked into the hotel lobby, wondering where I was going to find Guy. Tried to call him a couple of times, and of course, you're going to make a cell call on January the 20th, 2009, and no. As Ben Birch pointed out, that was probably the largest crowd that the United States has ever had to deal with in one place. At any time. And so, no cell. So I finally just walk around through the lobby. And the lobby of this hotel is just thronged with people in party clothes and ball gowns and itsy-bitsy little dainty slippers and patent tuxedo shoes and tuxedos of all varieties, single-breasted, double-breasted. And I walk around the corner, and there sits Guy James. And he looks at me, and I look at him, and at the same time I'm saying Guy, he's saying Bob. Guy Bob. You know, Bob Guy. And Guy has been to hell in a hand car over the last 48 to 72 hours. And we just sort of, you know, never having laid eyes on each other, entered into a sort of an easy conversation that would continue for the next 48. And what a magnificent trip it was. That evening was far and away not over yet. Guy was doing Radio Row from this hotel, but it was not where he had been staying. And so we set about on, and really this stuff, what DC was that night was Homeric. Because we stood in the freezing cold outside the hotel for a while, waiting like Odysseus on the island for some passing ship to take us away from our stranding. And we finally got a cab. And you know, big shout out to the DC cabbies, by the way. God, those people are good. Wouldn't take their job for love nor money. So we get in and explain to him that we need, you know, we're, you know, just a very short way from the Capitol building itself, and we explained to him that we need to get to the other side of the Capitol, and then we need to go up New Hampshire Avenue. Basically, two different directions. I can do that, he says. So he thought. Guy and I were then in a cab for an hour and 10 minutes as this cabbie negotiated every quadrant of Washington, D.C., slowly snaking his way around blockades and traffic realignments and diversions until an hour and 10 minutes later we finally wound up. And I drove by the Kennedy Center, drove by the Lincoln Memorial, drove by the Washington Monument, drove by the Capitol, Supreme Court. I mean, if there was any... And by the way, let me just throw this out as an aside. If Guy James ever decides to open a sideline to the radio gig, I strongly suggest that it be personal Washington tour guide. If you want to go to D.C. and know the history, and know the majesty, and the beauty of everything that went into the creation of this republic and our republic's capital, Guy James is the guy to do that for you. There isn't a corner to a building that Guy doesn't know something about, and I mean it in a good way. If I had the ability, I would pack up Agnes and the kids, make arrangements with Guy, and say, you know, we'll meet you in D.C. and get started, because he has an encyclopedic knowledge of that town, and what's more important, a love of that town. So we finally wandered our way to where we would be staying the night, and just stood there looking at each other, amazed at what we had been through. I mean, we had, Lord knows, just as with Odysseus, we heard the siren song. Oh, we heard lots of siren songs. I'm not sure yet what passes for the Lotus Eaters or the Cyclops, but I'm sure we passed them or had some sort of dealings with them along the way. But we finally got where we were going, and then that opened up the next can of worms, otherwise known as neither Guy nor I had eaten a blessed thing since about 7 o'clock that morning, and Guy might not have even eaten then. And that and sore, foot sore and tired and worn out. And Guy exhilarated from what he had seen with the inauguration, and I exhilarated by what I had seen of America just trying to get into Washington, D.C. We finally laid our burdens down and went in search of a bite. And I tell you what a day that was. I mean, what a day that was. And I haven't even begun to tell the story yet. Well, we haven't even gotten to day two. But we will. And it was simply something to behold. And I don't know that this country will ever see its like again. Even if, and it's way too early to talk about this sort of thing because there's so much work to be done, even if Barack Obama is reelected in 4 years, that inaugural will not be this inaugural. This was something for the ages. This was something the likes of which certainly cannot be compared with anything, at least back to Andrew Jackson's inaugural and the great big cheese on the White House lawn. This is stunning. And of course, if you heard earlier, there were logistical nightmares, and the fact that a Utah
a Utah senator had a hand in setting this thing up. Do you think for a minute that a Republican would deliberately try to screw up an inaugural and crowd management? I do. You're darn right. You're absolutely right. So I'm going to take a little break. You can chime in if you want to. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. Locally, 304-658-3333. Take a little break. I'm a little parched in the throat. I haven't filibobstered for 50 consecutive minutes in a while. And we'll continue the tale. This is Conversation Radio on America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
so we'll start the second hour a little early. I mean, you know, maybe we'll make up for some of the hours I missed in the last couple of days. A couple of quick emails rolling in, then a trip to the telephones, and I'll finish these stories as the evening progresses. This in from our pal Marty, who notes Angelenos don't know how to use a metro. Well, that's true. I was thinking in other terms, but yeah, maybe someday rapid transit will meaningfully just stop. From our pal Cindy in Washington, thanks for such a wonderful story. You realize there are over 5 million wonderful stories coming out of D.C. this week? Yeah, I do, and that's the beauty of it. I saw a 5-year-old who will be telling 3- and 5-year-olds their story from that day when Flying Spaghetti Monster willing, or what deity of your choosing, they are 90. And with any luck, it will be a story of the beginning of the beginning, the rebirth of America. Cindy adds, your story is really inspiring. You know, Republicans never could spell. Back in their heyday, it was known as morning in America, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, because that was the truth. Welcome home. Glad you're back. We missed you. Thanks, Cindy. And of course, these people are they're gonna. I mean, you know, everybody's heard the Flush Flimball thing by now. I hope he fails. I do. Well, you know, Flush, I hope you get hit by a garbage truck. Okay. I mean, while we're out there working the hope department, I hope you turn Flush Flimball. I hope you turn into a bad joke. Oh wait, you already are a bad joke. No, but you know the joke about what's the difference between Flush Flimball dead in the middle of the road and a skunk dead in the middle of the road? Skid marks in front of the skunk. God, I despise that man. Cindy also notes that she has seen what I saw, who I saw. She says, when I lived in Los Angeles, I saw this every single night on my way home from work. I used to hand out what I could afford wherever I could. I spent 2 years homeless myself there. It wasn't fun. She says, I moved to the country for stability. People are homeless here, but our community built a gigantic building for them with kitchens and cooks and beds and living rooms and TVs and doctors dropping by. We're very proud of that center. It's the size of a grocery store. And you know what? That's a noble thing for a people in a republic based upon democratic principles to spend the people's money on. Because as that, hey, wait a minute, you know what, I don't ever have to do that stupid voice again. I almost did. You know, I'll have to catch myself from time to time. And a little reminder, not that you would know this, but a little reminder. I started in radio at 15, very nearly 16, with a hot little driver's license in my pocket and raring to go. And with those exceptions, and it was a short exception, I never, whether it was with the exception of that first year and a half or so behind the mic at the Gospel Voice, after that, whether it was being the youngest news anchor ever to broadcast a radio newscast worldwide, or working a summer job in college or the local campus radio station, or discovering my passion for talk radio a few years later, in none of those, or here, or on terrestrial radio in Beckley, never, with that exception of those first few months behind the mic early on, never have I keyed the mic when some motherless, soulless, godforsaken Republican wasn't busy screwing up my country. So I will beg your indulgence as we go forward these next few months, because I don't quite know how to take this. I may not know how to do this,
But I hope you'll come along for the ride and help me out if it seems like I'm not banging on all eight, okay? But that's another one of those poetic little moments that sort of hit me between the eyes. I went, wow! I've never done, I mean, I was doing other things during the Clinton administration. But radio and being behind a microphone wasn't one of them. I've never done this without some pig, whether it be in the White House or fouling up the Congress. I've never done this. Been behind a microphone without my country being under assault from the people who hate the notion of democracy more than just about anybody else on the planet. So, to the extent that perspective is everything, there's the perspective. Let's go to the phones. Luke is with us from East Tennessee. Hey, Luke, welcome to the program.
Evening, Bob.
How are you?
Doing well, I hope. It was 6 degrees here 3 days ago. Tomorrow it's going to be 60.
I know. It was just blue butt cold when I left here, and I touched down at Beckley International, and it was a balmy 45.
I know. All right, let's see. I saw today they had, or I guess it was today, they had the retirement thing for Howard Dean. And I hope they keep the 50-state initiative going, because we got to remember, if we've got Obama in, we've got a good group right now, but in 2 years, with a whole bunch of them are up for election again. I'm sorry to bring it up, but he's going to need help to do some of these things.
Yeah, and, you know, there's the election in 2 years, especially where the Congress is concerned, isn't – there's a lot more Republicans up than there are Democrats.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean
– but if you're going to get it done, you got 2 years to get it done in for sure.
But you know what I mean? This is the time to get it done if we're going to get it done. Because you and I both know our states are unfortunately trending red.
Yeah, so, well.
But you know what I mean? We need to.
No, you've already got a political carnival taking place in Tennessee, Luke.
Oh, I sent you that thing, or David may have told you about it, about the Democrats turned the Republicans upside down. They had fun doing it, too. Lose the state house and still manage to put the fellow they want in at the head.
Yeah, I mean, if they can't have their guy, they'll have somebody they can at least work with, as opposed to some snake-handling, floor-rolling, tongue-speaking freak.
And well, apparently, and if you read some of the papers around here, them guys are just spitting mad. This is so much fun.
Oh, I bet they are. And, you know, I mean, that's like the two southbound ends of a northbound jackass who voted against the Hillary Clinton yesterday.
Yeah,
for nothing more than obstruction.
Well, look who it was. Jim Demented, as I call him, and Mr. Vitter, Hooker's best friend.
Yep.
But, you know, but you were talking a minute ago about the pig man. Apparently, like I say, he's on this rampage. But did you see the notice in one of the trade packs? I hear that Clear Channel's having to cut back.
Yes. Yes, they are.
They're having to cut back 10% or something.
Well, that's...
They may be asking the pig man about getting some money back from him.
Flush, we can't...
That won't happen, but...
We can't afford that $40 million anymore, Flush. What? How am I going to pay for this 26,000-square-foot mansion that I share with a stray cat?
Well, I just sent you the thing about Grover Norquist. The fellow from U.S. News and World Report said Grover Norquist may be the Democrats' best friend, because they said if the Republicans keep following this guy... It's like, say, they're just driving over the cliff, waving as they do it.
And I had a lot of interesting conversations yesterday evening. But one of them entailed a Senate Democrat telling me that the problem is that the Republicans think that the Democrats rose to their reached their ascendancy or cured their ills by playing more to the left. And, you know, we're us. Darned if I know who that was.
I was going to say, I remember seeing Mr. Kucinich in the race. But that was about, you know, it's like, you know, I mean, I like Mr. Obama, and I hope everything goes well, but I ain't going to call him on the left side of the party.
No, you know, I have yet to catch him whistling the Internationale or anything. Right, but But the funny part of that story, Luke, was the follow up when I said, "So you're telling me that because I was told the Republicans want to emulate what we did now, only with their side of it." I said, "Now wait a minute. They hope to get well by getting weirder."
Oh yeah.
And the senator said, "You got it.
It's the best way to go." I mean, it's like I'm sitting there going, "Oh, please stick Newt out there every night to say something, or can we get Hot Tub Tom out there somewhere to talk on the microphone, please?"
Yeah.
Every time they appear, their numbers go down. This is good. We like it. You know, it's like the big man. The big man and him and Hannity. People are watching it. I mean, you know, and we know they're 35% that they always get are going to watch it and love it. But the people they're trying to get the middle ground. People are looking at that and going, "Damn, they ain't going to go near them people. They're nuts."
And the thing, I got to tell you, Luke, I got up in the hotel room this morning and it had real cable in it. Not this two dented tin cans and a string affair that we've got here that only delivers Fox, which means I don't watch TV. But anyway, I got up and, you know, boop, CNN. You know, why not? Tell me the choices I have at, you know, 6 a.m. So, no, not any of the main.
4 o'clock last night.
Right. But, so I flick on CNN and they're doing their morning show and they're doing an entire segment on that stupid quote from Flimball. And on the one hand, I'm thinking, yeah, show the world what an ass he is. But on the other, I'm thinking, you know, that man more than probably, man, I use the term loosely, more than anyone else in the world understands that there is no such thing as bad publicity. And he knew what he was saying, and he knew it would be talked about from home to Rome. And he is reaping a PR bonanza off of it.
Oh yeah. Well, it's one of those things where some people have got to come out there and just absolutely slam him for it. I think, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, on some of these discussion shows, one thing that bugs me is, okay, for the last 8 years, we've had Republicans. So of course they've had all these people, the CNNs and some of the other alphabets. Well, of course we have to have these people from the Heritage Foundation on to tell us what's going on. And I'm sitting there going, okay, so fine, we're in now. When are we going to see somebody other than the Heritage Foundation or the Eagle Forum or whatever? And I turned on the other day, and there's somebody from the Heritage Foundation, and I'm sitting there going, why are you going to these people? They don't know.
Well, they'll bring you some diversity. They'll have somebody on from the Cato Institute next.
Oh, yeah. Or the, I was going to say Hoover, but no. What would be a good one or two of the other. I try not to think about them too much. You know how that goes. But you know, that's one
American Enterprise Institute, U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
But you know, it's one of those things that we've got to get the people out there on our side talking and making. They have to start screaming their names occasionally. You know, it's one of those things. I saw the thing on the MSNBC guy says now he wants a 10 o'clock show. I'm sitting there going, gee, now let's see. 8 years ago, you threw some guy named, or 6 years ago, you threw some guy named Donahue off the air. Who are you going to get?
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, it's one of those things. I mean, you know, I'm sitting there going, you know, this would be a wonderful time to stick Malloy on, but they'd never stick Malloy on.
No, the cameras would catch fire.
I was sitting there going,
sidelight. Speaking of media vanity, the Progressive Media Summit yesterday was held in the Russell Senate Office Building. And I've got a photo of a guy and a photo of me pointing to a list of all the historic things that actually I'm pointing because Guy had the camera. I said, "Hey, Bob, point at something." Yeah, I'm not that creative. But all the one of the things that took place in the room where we had this Progressive Media Summit was Sam Ervin's Watergate hearings.
Oh,
farm folk will tell you that in the height of summer, if you're real still at night, you can hear the corn grow. It was the same thing in that room. You could just hear history whispering from the columns. The Teapot Dome scandal hearings were held in that room. I mean, there have been more Republicans felled in that room. And what a magnificent place to hold the summit.
Is that where they hung McCarthy out to dry? I'm trying to remember if that was it or not.
Well, the Kefauver hearings were held there.
The Army hearings?
Doggone it!
I can't remember where it was.
I don't have the photos loaded onto my production machine yet, so I can't. But it was a heck of an impressive list. So anyway, the guy and I walk out because there's it's got a rotunda in it, similar I guess to the Capitol, and this beautiful west facing view of the Capitol through the magnificent windows and everything, gorgeous architecture, and this view of. You know, of the Capitol and through the other corner down to the Washington Monument. And as Guy had pointed out to me, this is where all the networks do their stand-ups.
They all stand there in the semicircle and everybody's standing 5 foot from everybody else.
Yeah, and so I just walked it because I hadn't seen down into the, you know, into the well there because we were on like the third floor. And I'm standing there looking, you know, because, you know, I looked at the guy and I said, look, I'm a tourist. If you're a tourist, be a tourist. Don't try to act like you know the place. So I just stood there with my mouth hanging open catching flies. And lo and behold, here's this TV geek down to my left who's like he's landing a wounded fighter on an aircraft carrier, you know, waving me off. Get out of my shot. And, you know, little old tourist me, oh, Jesus, jumps back. The guy looks at me, nerve of him. I'll get me shot. I know my rights. Where's the sheriff? Oh, it was wonderful. It was just a magnificent experience, I tell you.
Oh, I tell you.
But, you know, do not get between the bubble-headed bleach blonde who comes on at 5 and tells you about the plane crash with a gleam in her eye and the beautiful Washington background sunset. Don't do that.
They will drive up one side of you and down the other.
Yes, they will. And I mean, they will tell you how to get to the corner of go to hell and you and when to get off.
I want to bring up a story that I saw and I sent to you. That's one of those little stories, like I say, that'll slip through the cracks if we ain't paying attention. The story about the trees out in the western U.S.
Oh, I've been on planes, trains, and automobiles all day. I think I missed it.
It's one where they found out that the rate of trees out there are dying faster. Yes.
Oh, there it is. Yeah, trees in western U.S. forests dying due to climate change. Mm-hmm. Well, thank heaven it's only a myth, because those are mythical trees, right?
Well, next week I also sent you something. Mr. Gore is going to be up in Washington appearing before the Foreign Relations Committee. And there's also a story out there, I didn't send it to you, about the fact that apparently the melting is starting to hit Antarctica now. It's done well with the Arctic. Now it's coming down to Antarctica.
Yeah, because it is the height of summer down there right now. I was just noting John Fox in the chat room talking about what the temperature is right now. And it's still, you know, it's summer there, but I imagine that's a bit toasty yet. And it's going to get toastier.
You know, one thing right after the other, you know what I mean? They just had that flooding up in Washington State. You know, we just went through that. You know, just little things that after a while you start adding them all together, and it's like, something's wrong here, son. Oh, the other thing, one other story I'm going to head on down the road because they're about to come in here and vacuum in my office. I don't want to get vacuumed up. I saw the thing where they've announced Mr. Mitchell going over to the Middle East.
Yes.
And I'm sitting there going, at least they're deciding to do it at the beginning of the thing. We're not waiting until the last 5 minutes of the 4 years.
Well, hear to that.
I mean, I say, let's get this started now. Let's keep it going until they get it right, which, of course, may take 4 years. But, hey, got to at least try.
Well, indeed you do. And, of course, there's been some – you know, I mean, this is the guy who brokered the deal between the IRA and
the Irish.
Yeah, and the Orangemen, shall we say.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that was no small accomplishment. I mean, they had a lot of kinship and in common stuff going on with the Israelis and the Palestinians, really, when you get right down to it.
Yeah, he probably wouldn't get involved. You know who really would reach out and touch on this?
Who's that?
H.W. Bush. Daddy Bush. Because, like I say, he's got all the friends over there.
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe he could strong-arm some of his Saudi business partners.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what they're going to have to do is get – I think they're going to get everybody involved over there.
Well, and that's the first thing, get involved. But George Mitchell got himself in a big stink early on, and I'm not criticizing him for this. I mean, how the hell can you be that without saying this? got himself in hot water because he said, he said there's going to have to be a sustained cessation in people shooting at people. And somehow, you know, that doesn't exactly strike me as nuts. If you're trying to getting people to stop shooting at people is a great way to foster the, you know, peace.
That's a pretty good first step. I'm sorry, you know.
But
it's hard to work with people while you're shooting each other.
Right, but not according to some quarters. Oh no. That's being too soft on them. You can't be soft on those people if you don't let us shoot them.
If you're going to push it, you ain't going to get some of them. Some of them ain't going to do it. They don't matter what. You know what I mean? They're still going to just keep on shooting. But yeah, I mean that's.
But if you can get more people, if you can get more people not shooting than people shooting, you can isolate the shooting and maybe talk them down talk them off the rooftops.
Yeah.
But
well, I tell you what, Bob, I got to go on.
Yeah, they're going to run that vacuum, and that makes for some that makes for some tough radio look. Good to hear from you, my friend.
Glad you had a good trip.
All right, thanks. Be careful.
Thanks, bye
now. We'll keep it rolling here. You know the phone number 877-443-2366 or 304-658-3333. Oh, no, you didn't wait. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello? Yo, hello.
Hello?
Yeah, hello.
Hello, this is... I got to get the... turn the computer down so I can talk to you. And how are you tonight?
I am doing well, Reverbo. Good to hear from you, brother.
Yeah, you, so do you, travel by air a lot, or what?
No more than I have to.
I see. You had me, laughing at some of those stories. God, man, I have been, the air travel is just filled with hellacious delay stories, and looking out at both sides of the aircraft, and you see the same sight, and this just comes with the territory.
Well, it's just no fun, but see, it hasn't always been not fun.
It is nice that George Jr. got to thumb his nose at you for one last time. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, okay, one last thing with the voice. Hey, Bob, look down at your shoes. See what I'm doing?
So how close would you say you were to Obama?
To Obama? I don't think at any point in time I was in the same area code with him.
Oh, you weren't. Oh, okay.
No, I was. I was strictly afterwards. I mean, just no.
Okay. So where exactly were you? I don't mean to go over this again. During the whole inaugural.
Well, during the inaugural, I was either on the road to the. I was either on the road to Beckley International, or in the air. You know, seeing the greater southeastern United States.
Okay, now I'm getting an idea.
Because I mean, this guy, honest to God, Reverbo, this guy was flying all over creation. Because, you know, but the piloting things is that you learn to, you know, you make the little turns. They like to make the turns flat so as not to flip out the passengers.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, we were doing those airline commercial turns, you know, where you know you're flying along with both wings pointing at the horizon, and the next thing one wing's pointing at the ground, and the other wing's pointing at the sun. You know, we were doing those.
Yeah, those are ones. Yeah, your stomach ends up pointing somewhere else with some of those.
Yeah, yeah. It took me at least 15 minutes on the ground to get my appetite back, and that's saying something.
Oh man. So so I have some notes from the whole experience, and no doubt you've seen it, and you've got some reviews about this. I don't even know where to start about this, except Rick Warren was just awful.
Well, that's really the only word. See, I got all that on the radio, so I didn't get to hate him visually.
Okay,
but
visually he's not good.
No, he's Jerry. If he shaves the stupid little chin rug, he's Jerry Falwell.
I don't know why they have to. I mean, it was just a horrible speech from a hack evangelist. I mean, this guy Rick Warren, he gets up there and he just all Rick's power, according to Rick, comes from Yahweh. Okay. And you just wanted to, after a while, you just wanted to say, whoa, easy, Rick. You got some serious issues, my man.
Well, see, we were going down the road, and it was along about the same time I was having the Buddy Holly, Big Bopper, Richie Valens conversation. And then they introduced the pastor, Rick Warren. And I said, oh, wait, everybody be quiet. It was me, my son-in-law, and Agnes. She doesn't like to drive in snow, so son-in-law was along for the ride. I said, wait, we got to listen to this. I said, there's things I'm listening for. You know, because I know the code, Reverbo. I've got the secret decoder ring that I got in a box of Jesus Puffs one time when I was a kid. And so I start listening, and I'm thinking, oh, they're not happy yet. They're not happy yet. The fundies aren't happy yet. He hasn't said, nope, hadn't dialed up Jesus yet. And then he ends with what Christians refer to as the Lord's Prayer. Oy. And I thought, those little freaks are going to be so happy. He brought Jesus to them. All them Hindus and Muslims, they finally heard about Jesus for the first time. Oh, I'm going to start speaking in tongues. And it was revolting. And the thing was, it wasn't even, I mean, there was talk way back about how, you know, the mantle of Billy Graham has been transferred to Rick Warren. You know what? That man is not fit to carry Billy Graham's baptizing gown. I don't care who you are. Even after you found out about Billy Graham sitting around with Richard Nixon in the Oval Office gooning on the Jews, which he did. Well, Billy, they're all like that out in Hollywood. Oh, I know, Mr. President. Even after you found out about that, you know, still the guy could captivate an audience, and that ain't Rick Warren.
Warren is just a hack. I just kept thinking, God, there were so many other people you could have had. If you want to be inclusive, there's other denominations and there's other. I mean, the guy was simply all. He's a horrible speaker. I hadn't paid much attention to him before, except for reading his words. You know, I was prepared for bad. I just wasn't prepared for this bad. I mean, it's just God. Somebody just put that guy in a bag.
Well, it was Monday night when I played the audio of him from 2005 comparing himself to who was it? Lenin, yeah. Hitler, yeah. And Mao. Not me comparing him to that, but him comparing himself to that. And I don't know how desperate the evangelical Christianity is for something in the way of inspiring rhetoric, but they're fishing in a pretty pretty shallow barrel to pull up Rick Warren as the best they got.
Yeah, it was just a miss. The whole thing, really. I thought, you know, other than Obama's speech, really it was pretty much of a letdown. I mean, it was one of those things that it's way more, the journey was way more fun than the destination was for me. I mean, I thought Elizabeth Alexander, she was the woman who gave the inaugural poem.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you heard that.
No, I did not.
It was basically just it was a high school snoozer. It was like a ninth grade, you know, selection by the high school literary magazine.
Yeah, it was no Robert Frost in The Gift outright.
It was horrible. I mean, so most of it was just sort of mediocre.
That, well, it makes me feel kind of good about reading Let America Be America again Monday evening. That's a poem.
Oh, yeah. That was, this thing would make good. And then, of course, you had, I think they had to bump everything up at, Turgeon was bumped everything up to condition red after he saw Aretha's hat. They thought that thing was going to accidentally go off. You never did see Aretha Franklin's chapeau, did you?
No, I did not.
Okay, it was quite the thing. It was like a Saturn V up there. It was pretty sweet. But
cool.
Moving along, we had a. What's the deal with Chief Justice Roberts? I couldn't memorize 34.
Moron!
Yeah, just basically moron. And plus, here's Obama trying to save him, and he just refuses to be saved.
And that's the thing. You know, people, well, I heard it said a couple of times, they blew the oath. And I looked at a couple of folks and said, now hold your horses, Buster. They didn't blow anything. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States of America blew the oath.
He couldn't even read. It's right in front of him. He's got a cheat sheet right in front of him. He couldn't even read the word.
Cheat sheet? He's got the Constitution. It's in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
And, you know, I heard the oath given by Stevens to Biden. And, again, I understand the point. That whole so help me God business, I don't know, maybe it's in the statutory language for the vice president, but it is not in the Constitution of the United States. If Barack Obama wanted to say so help me God, cool, let him. Because that's a tradition begun not by chief justices of the Supreme Court, but by presidents who answer so help me God. Harry Truman was one of those. Harry Truman also kissed the Bible because Harry Truman was a serious member of the Masonic Lodge. And they kiss Bibles and say so help me God and stuff like that. But it's not in the Constitution, and it's not required, and there really should be. You know, now Michael Newdow's got several years to work on this, and he needs to get it, because we've got the precedent now, Reverbo, of having to go back and have a stickball, sandlot baseball do-over of the oath when the Chief Justice screws it up. Well, let's get it entirely right, and forbid the Chief Justice as a function of constitutional law from ever compelling an elected president to say, so help me God. Not because of anything about God, not because of any, frankly, atheism, agnosticism, free thinking, but because it ain't constitutional. You know, so help me God is also not in the First Amendment, Second Amendment, Third, Fourth, Fifth, or any of them. And yet, let's say some hotshot lawyer's got some pleadings before the Supreme Court, and he quotes the First Amendment and puts, so help me God, at the end of that, even the Supreme Court has to look at it and go, sorry, that's not in the First Amendment. But here, what do you got? Nah, you got Justice Roberts, who's more worked up about getting his so help me God in that's not in. And I think that's probably part of what screwed him up.
Maybe it was.
Because Newdow brought that suit. And everybody knew about it, and suddenly Roberts had to look at, well, I'll be damned, so help me God ain't in there, so help me God. And that probably, yeah, because when you're memorizing stuff and you're not used to memorizing stuff, things like that can be, you know, a feather in the back of the throat, metaphorically speaking. And I wouldn't be surprised if you were to get the Chief Justice all liquored up and make him tell the truth, that he'd tell you that's what took him off the rails.
They got it right this morning, I guess.
Yeah. Like I said, do-over. Yeah. Ghost man on second.
I mean, you don't even have to rehearse together. Jack, it's 34 words, and you're reading it.
Well,
I just thought that there was just something about that it's just like you having to wait for Bush's plane and, you know, them getting the oath wrong just a tiny bit and Rush.
Oh, but you want the ultimate indignity? I really can top it all, because this was my other morning with CNN moment. I was getting ready to jump into the shower to get ready to do Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And I had to come bolting back out into the room. Guy was by this time gone, otherwise it would have been a horror. I come bolting with a towel wrapped around me to back out of the room because I hear the opening of this reader story about how the Bush twins left a letter for Sasha and Malia telling them how to be the first daughters. And I thought I was going to run my head through the television. Well, girls, granted, you're a little bit under the age of being able to drink liquor legally, what with y'all being, you know, in the single digits yet and not even teenagers and all, but that never slowed us down none. So make sure that you don't try to slip off behind from the Secret Service when you go to get all liquored up at the roadhouse in Austin. That's our first piece of advice for you, girls. You know, I couldn't believe it. And what is this business with George leaving Barack a letter? Did you catch any of that?
No, this is wildness to me. Well, what's in his letter?
I don't know. It's, you know, advice. I mean, these America's single most useless welfare queen family, the Bushes, can't stand. Not having it. Hey, look, you got the video. Did you see George Bush's parting wave bye-bye when he got on Marine One?
I didn't see that. The helicopter picks you up at the back of the White House.
He gets on Marine One, and you know it's not one of it's you know it's not Richard Nixon with both arms and oh I'm out of here. It's not that one. And it's not you know the Queen of England screwing in the light bulb or Miss America and the windshield wiper thing. So yeah, if we were doing video, I'm doing all those waves right now.
Oh no, I'm with I know everyone.
No. George waves bye bye. Like my almost 2-year-old granddaughter waves bye bye.
Opening and closing your hand.
Open hand and shaking it like he's got an ugly dose of St. Vitus dance. Bye.
This guy is disturbed.
Well, now he's on vacation forever.
I read that he took 77 vacations over his 8-year term.
Yes.
77. And, well, yeah, we
my dad lived to 82 and didn't get 77 vacations.
It's nice to take all those vacations while people are dying and, you know, people are, you know, getting...
Yeah. It's good. It's good to be the king.
Oh, it is good to be the king. The, it was great to watch. I turned it off after I didn't even see any of the parade or anything, but it was great to hear him. Here's Bush sitting right next to the podium, right, on his side. Yeah, the other side is like Obama's family and his guests and all that. And there's Bush sitting right there, and here's Obama just launching into this. The whole theme of his speech, right, is restoration, return to the truth, reunite. I'm reading from my notes here, reuniting our safety and our ideals, leading with dignity. I mean, he was just taking shots, this guy. I mean, you couldn't get more obvious than that. And, it was really, it was amazing. I was impressed. I was impressed with the speech. I mean, he didn't really hold back. He it was a dignified speech, but I mean, he just basically just, gave him a couple right across the chops, I thought.
There were a couple of them. Now, granted, I didn't, and to be fair, history isn't here yet. But I didn't hear any, ask not for what your country can do for you, and I didn't hear any all we have to fear is fear itself. I didn't hear any of those. I heard a very straightforward, inspired piece of oratory that fits in the latter years of the first decade of the 21st century. We don't do that. We as a people, I mean, look, you just cited Rick Warren and how he was. We as a people do not have the oratorical skills that we once did. With all the respect in the world that I have for Barack Obama, he can't do. America, if this makes any sense, Reverbo, America can't hear I Have a Dream anymore. America's ears are not tuned to ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. The very construction of that sentence alone is antithetical to an American ear that now has the better part of a generation text messaging each other using prepositions and you know short form spelling and you know, goodbye grammar, goodbye punctuation, spelling, forget it. We don't. I, honest to God, and I hope I'm not being negative because that's not the point I'm trying to make. We don't have that capacity anymore.
Then he's got to bring it back.
Well, and I think he is slowly. I mean, if you ask me to side by side compare. His speech, the closing night of the Democratic National Convention with the inaugural speech, I think the closing night is clearly far and away a better piece of oratory. But you know what? It was 17 degrees and God only knows what with the wind chill out there. Among other things that piece of oratory was, that piece of oratory was merciful. Okay? Just like Abraham Lincoln wrote the Gettysburg Address on the train on the way to Gettysburg, and it took less than, what, 2.5 minutes to deliver? And the guy who spoke before Lincoln on a November day in Gettysburg, which ain't exactly balmy, was 3 hours, and Lincoln stands up and does 2.5 minutes and sits down and feels bad about it? sometimes getting your point across and doing it mercifully and not making people stand in hellish conditions to do it, there is frankly an element of politeness to it.
It wasn't nice and short. I was impressed. He can go on, and when I heard him speak in Wilmington, which is where I live, I thought his speech was too long, and I'd love to hear him talk to me all night long. But
he whose name must now not be spoken anymore made people stand in the rain to hear him orate. I mean, there are different standards of comparison here. I mean, that guy babbled in the rain. Pardon?
You speaking of the old Maverick? Well, we'll have to talk the old Maverick.
Yeah, I'm talking about the Decider.
Oh, the Decider. Yeah. Oh God. As for your point about whether the average person 25 years old can understand that, you know, things like eloquence and, you know, something poignant in a speech like Kennedy's or some of this stuff. Well, all I can say is that you and I can.
Yes.
We're still thumping around.
But we're too, and this is not a function of whatever our age is, Reverbo. This is a function of being attuned to it. Okay? Ask not what your country can do for you. No. Don't ask what your country can do for you. But the deliberate stylistic oratorical convention is ask not. You know, that's Shakespearean. That's the same Elizabethan English that we get regardless of content, the beauty of the Shakespeare of the Elizabethan English that's in the King James Bible. It's a convention. It is a rhetorical oratorical skill that very few people have. I was at a press conference a while back regarding the wind campaign that our friends down at Coal River Mountain Watch have going on, and I delivered a few remarks regarding how we feel about wind campaigns over here on my side of the river, and I threw out a yay verily. You know, just...
Wow.
Yeah, I threw a yay verily out, and the poor little bobbleheads from local media were like, what'd he say? Yay, Mountaineers. What?
Oh, man. Well, I think that's cool. If I'd have been in the audience and heard you say that, I would have giggled silently.
Well, yeah, and some people did, and they were supposed to. Because it's a matter of trying to call people back from... And a lot of this, wow, we could do hours on this, Reverbo. A lot of this has to do with the necessity of messaging in an advertising age where 30 seconds costs $500,000.
Oh. I mean, there are so many levels that you can talk about appreciating this sort of thing. It's not just the message, it's how you deliver the message and the whole art of oration.
For the most part, Reverbo, it is not taught in the schools.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and you're gonna love it. I gotta run this. No, I'll wait. But I've got a scene here from the official Head On Radio Network mascot movie Idiocracy, and our buddy Albert is pointing out that this is where we're going. If you've never seen Idiocracy, it is a must.
I've seen
it. The audio from the House of Representatives. You know, 500 years from now. Yeah. Hey, Reverbo, this is great. I got them stacked to the wall, so I'm gonna move along, have a few more conversations. But great observations, my friend.
Okay, good to talk to you, and I'll catch up later.
All right, take care.
Okay.
Bye. Hey, even though we got a new administration, you know what, right? Make it personal.
Don't ever forget. Later, my friend.
Bye now. Reverbo calling from North Carolina and rolling along. Hey, welcome to the program.
Blah, 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 do. I love you.
Sorry, I'm speaking in tongues, bro. Shamalama, ding dong. I love you.
I love you. The Lord be with you.
Welcome to Costco.
I love you. Oh, my goodness gracious.
What's up, Albert?
I'll tell you, that scene did perfectly fit in every way, shape, and form. I couldn't get it out of my head.
No, I got it here. Let's subject people to it.
All right, yeah, bring it.
Yeah, stand by. From yeah, and that's what it is. This is the Horn mascot movie. That is what, isn't it? That's what it is.
It is, amen. One thing just to remember, those who haven't seen it, when the president is speaking, it's on the teleprompter, just for...
Yeah, he's reading from a teleprompter. This is 500 years, this is the United States 500 years in the future. Wink, wink. Arena light blinking, House of Representatives. Very visual.
Sit your monkey ass down. Chill out. Shit.
On the teleprompter.
Bullshit. And the dust storms. And we running out of French fries and burrito covers.
Yeah.
But I got a solution.
That's what you said last time.
God. Oh.
Sorry.
No, the funny thing is that the language is described by the narrator early in the film, Albert, as a strange mix of what?
Hillbilly.
Yeah.
Inner city slang.
Hillbilly, inner city slang, and I forget what the third one is.
What is the third one?
But really, that's...
Grunts.
Yeah, there's grunts. Grunts, inner city slang, and hillbilly. that's okay. I got told by I was on my best behavior, Albert. I really, really was. Mm-hmm. I got told by a guy yesterday at the Progressive Media Summit, not a senator or anything. They're far better than that. An attendee looked me in the eye. I'd already identified myself as coming from West Virginia. And he talked about the thinning of the gene pool and said, and after a while, we're all just a bunch of booger-eating hillbillies. Say thank you, Bob. Thank you for not reaching all the way back into Mingo County and bringing that fist all the way forward into his face. Because, you know, I don't think they've been doing fisticuffs in anything housing the Congress in quite some time, so I'm glad I didn't. Booger eating hillbillies.
Yeah. No, see, they should. They should have. There are some aspects of it. Let's not forget President Not Sure's speech when he becomes president after Hector Macho Camacho Mountain Dew Alonzo is president, who's the one we've heard. President Not Sure, who would be the 638th president of representing, he stated that he wanted to see a day when we could look at a movie of an ass and wonder whose ass it was that's farting and why it's funny and why it itches. And that he believed that those days could come again. And I think that kind of fits into where Barack Obama has to kind of, you know, obviously that's the direction that the plane needs to be going. You know, I definitely got to applaud you because I would never let, I mean, you know, I did see on probably way too many hallucinogens. I saw the movie and wait, like second, first row, it was ridiculous, Castaway on too many hallucinogens.
By the way, before we get too far past it, yeah, it's a mixture of inner city slang, valley girl,
yeah,
and hillbilly and grunts.
And grunts, yeah. We knew. Well, it's all there. It's just a collage of wonderful Hardy, Carl's Jr. But anyway, you popped me now. Now I'm off. But
sorry, man.
Castaway. So yeah, and so after that I was like, and I have flown around the world a few times, so I've been enough. If anybody's ever been across the Pacific once or twice or five times, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about when you're like, I'm done with flying. But so you know, when you go into those turns, like you reminded me, like, man, you know, that's what I like about flying. I liked it kind of when the planes would do those banks. It's like, whoa, you know, it felt like we're flying, not like we're in this big stinky tube of cheap plastic and scratched up windows and stuff, you know, with crappy food. you know, when I would, the plane would do that, I would kind of almost enjoy that part of it. I'm a little bit opposite to where I couldn't ever, the thing my stomach couldn't take would be taking my shoes off. And, you know, whatever, I've been subject
to that. It makes me crazy, and I know that you can't make jokes. And
if I had
a nickel's worth more exhibitionism in me and brass, I would. Then if I flew in warm weather the next time I did it, I would show up at the security checkpoint in a Speedo and flip flops.
And you need a hat and sunglasses though too.
No, I just want to make it completely. No, come on, guys. You know, do I really have to walk through the metal detector? What can I? You know, I mean, I'm crazy enough to do this. You're crazy enough to say, get on the plane.
You know, I remember back before any of this terrorist hoopla came to be. Not hijacking, just the terrorist hoopla. I remember when it came in, I was flying out of New York for, I was going away back to the military from leave. And, they asked me the stupidest question I'd ever heard up until that point in my life is, did you pack your own bags? Now, that's just a really dumb question. It just is.
No, my man Belvedere did it for me.
No, see, that's not what hit me in the head. What hit me in the head was when I remember reading Mad Magazine as a little kid, and this, you know, these things are impressionable, let me tell you, because I was impressioned. And there was one of these, like, just strips where it was the same thing. It was the same kind of thing where the airline lady asked the guy, you know, did you pack your own bags? And he responds, and I said exactly what he said. He said, no, a nice man named Mr. Mustafa paid me $10,000 to pack this bag for me. And I said that, and she started laughing, because it's kind of funny, you know, and I was pretty cute, and so she liked that, and I was flirting around, but still, she's like, oh, you can't say that. I'm like, why? You think Mr. Mustafa paid me $10,000 to pack my luggage, and I'm going to carry it on the plane, and then I'm going to tell you?
See, Guy James did something similar to me yesterday. We're getting ready to go into the Russell Senate office building. And, you know, there's a Checkpoint Charlie right there inside the doorway with very humorless D.C. Capitol cops all done up in their darks and their blast-out pants and, yeah, and, you know, very, very serious-looking Glock sidearms that can easily shoot themselves in the foot, let alone what they could do to us. And so, you know, I'm taking off the belt and shoelaces and, guy looks over at the Capitol cops and goes, you know, I wouldn't let this guy in. He's clearly a subversive. And I just, yeah, and I gave myself whiplash, whipping my neck around, going, don't do that! These people are serious and heavily armed! No joking, it's just like the airport. And by this time, the cops are laughing.
Yeah.
So, that was a good thing. Guy and I work very well together. I had a blast over the last 2 days.
I'm glad. You know, see, no, but what Guy did is that's the right thing to do when you're operating police. See, you're not remembering your fear and loathing knowledge, wisdom base there. When you see a cop, don't pull over. That just raises contempt in the cop heart. You got to put the foot to the floor. You got to just go. Make the bastard chase you.
Make him earn it.
He'll chase you.
But I mean, Gitmo's almost closed, but I'm sure they got to make it. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Kincaid. We can work you in.
Well, I'll tell you
Look how pale I am. I'm terrible in orange.
See, here's the thing. If you would have bruised their ego in any way, shape, or form, then and there you would have been. That's when you get hassles, if you bruise their ego in any way, shape, or form. And, I mean, you know, like in the early days, which is when we were hearing about mothers drinking their own breast milk, when everybody was all, you know, everybody was so stressed out and afraid that, you know, it was really easy to bruise. Like, this is breast milk. Sure, it's breast milk. Drink it then. You know, like it became this power trip, you know, but really, basically, honestly, cops, They'll wind up doing things like that if you bruise their ego. I've been searched. I've been strip searched coming into international. It's not fun. And all I did was pet the guy's dog. So sorry.
Don't corrupt the attack dog, sir.
It kind of was like that, and it was exactly like that. It was because, oh, you want to pet my dog? It's not a dog. This is an officer. You know, this is Officer Gonzo. You know, it's just stupid.
Gee, where do you pin the brass on? That's got to hurt.
It turns them around hanging. They dangle on the dog, officers. But anyway, you know, what Rush Limbaugh said just makes me, I just want to blast out curse words in so many different languages.
Every language, I know, every language, yeah.
He is such, I mean, you know, hypocrisy knows no bounds with these people. Hypocrisy is that. Whatever that group of, I don't know, you know, because I don't even know who the hell to call these people anymore. You know, they're not conservative. They're not even fascists. I mean, they're a new breed of evil. I mean, like, they should make a horror movie out of these son of a bitches, because these people, there is nothing more contemptible than the crap that they say. Hang on. Barack Obama isn't even president. You want him to fail. Now, granted, it wasn't that I wanted Bush to fail.
You just knew he would.
Fail in 2004? Yeah, exactly. I knew he would, and not only that, I didn't agree with him. You know,
Look, it's okay, Albert, let's work at it this way. Coming into the presidency, which he initially stole, we knew the history of George W. Bush. We knew about Harkin Energy. We knew about Spectrum 7. We knew about Arbusto. We knew about the giant taxpayer ripoff that was the Texas Rangers baseball stadium. We knew about the frogs in the M80s butts, okay? We knew all this. We knew, and what's more, we knew about Poppy and that old beast Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
We knew about them burying their daughter at age 3 and going golfing that day. We had an abundance of empirically gathered data by which to determine that this man was going to be. We didn't have to hope, wish, or pray. We knew empirically that everything that George W. Bush would touch his hand to would, like some sort of reverse Midas, turn to caca on the spot.
Exactly. I mean, you know, want him to fail.
Imagine
how that made your skin crawl.
Because
the thing that I say, where I say, you know, I want to see a collapse, and that you see all the dead, starving children and everything else like that, and I kind of see, I'm looking further down the golden path. But, so I can imagine what he, like, see, me, I'd like
to... Oh, no. It engendered string theory power swearing. Because, but I tell you what, Albert, I got to give him this, and I'm the last guy on earth that would ever give Flush Flimball any credit at all. But I got to give him credit in this instance for the first time in his life being honest.
That's right. That's
because
right.
You know what?
Being honest.
Barack Obama and the things that the Democratic Party are going to try to accomplish in the United States in the next 4 years, and a lot of them have to happen in the next 2 if they are to happen at all, let's be honest. If they accomplish 70, 60, 55% of what they set out to do, the Republican Party, as we have known it, once and for all dead. I mean, I'm talking about silver bullets, staked through the heart, and buried in a pyramid of garlic dead.
Putting a sheet of glass and sent out into space to flip forever.
Yeah. But what, Corbomite?
Yeah, Corbomite.
With Barack Obama in the role of Billy D. Williams standing there watching him freeze. Only in this case, he's a good guy.
And no coming back either. There's none of that.
No. And you know, I'm sorry, Bush twins. You don't even get to have a chain around your neck sitting next to Jabba the Hutt. It don't happen.
No.
You go away and you live in obscurity. But I mean, it really is. We are looking, and I mentioned a guy yesterday
You know, because I can't get past my, you know, recovering Southern Baptist upbringing.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of the curse on Pharaoh. You know, whenever it was said that, you know, whatever Pharaoh does to you or says is going to happen to you is going to happen to him. You know, I'm rubber, you're glue, bounces off me and sticks to you. You know, there was Karl Rove not 8 years ago. Talking about, you know, these little egg-headed, you know, with the glasses and smarmy little, you know, he's still the same little kid who got his ass beat on the playground and still just needs it. But talking about creating a permanent Republican majority.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how's that working out for you, Carl? Just asking. You know, their ranks are diminishing by virtue of their own misdeeds. And the thing is, they had 8 years of a perfect so-called conservative storm. They could have had anything they wanted, and we didn't even have people for six of the 8 years. We didn't even have anybody who could stop them.
Exactly.
They got extremists onto the Supreme Court, and we got letters from we got statements from Robert Byrd about receiving letters that couldn't possibly have made it to the Senate in time that had the donut and jelly and coffee stains on it from being passed around the coffee table, talking about how they wanted Alito on the court. You know, I'll never forget that, and I won't forgive it either. We couldn't stop them. They were a juggernaut, and we took, you know, and they, you know, Karl Rove and Grover Norquist and all these monsters who use all of this eliminationist rhetoric, Albert. They were out there talking about how they didn't want to kill the Democrats. They just wanted to castrate them. I remember that, by God. And look where they are. Those whom they would castrate have just about, you know. I mean, they wished the angel of death upon the Democrats, and lo and behold, guess who came knocking at their door?
Mm-hmm.
How's that for some eliminationist rhetoric?
Oh, that fits more into the God that I would, if there was to be one, that would be the one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you can just imagine George sitting around going, "Where are all these frogs and locusts coming from?" You know, God knows with Iraq and Afghanistan and Lord knows what happened in Gaza. All that comes home to George Bush's doormat, and Lord knows, you know, okay, frogs, locusts, and he's damn sure got the river of blood.
Oh, I got pictures of it. I've got pictures of it from 2003 and 2004, and it's not a fun sight. It's pretty hideous, actually. And, you know, I just, one thing I want to say just to add on to what you just laid out, which is almost proof for God, but the fact is if Bush and company could have just been competent, we wouldn't be having the same conversation.
No.
They weren't even competent. I mean, they couldn't even they just couldn't even, like, cover the till with a fake receipt or something. They have blown it in almost every way, shape, and form. I mean, you know, you could talk about letters, or you could talk about little notes that I leave behind for you. But, you know, all those pleasantries aside, the son of a bitch still needs to go to jail. He has committed crimes above and beyond the call of duty, and it's somebody, and it's got to be him, and his party, in a sense, they literally have to pay. Because, you know, we can talk about bipartisan this and bipartisan that, and, you know, oh, that's all great and grand and wonderful. Just like, you know, with this evangelical right-wing freak being, you know, basically some sort of placating, you know, little like, I don't even know, just to toss them out there, you know, to kind of cool the rabbits. You know, it's the same deal with us. Okay, and it's not even so much with us, but it's in the struggle and the fight that we have. I mean, like, you know, it's like we have to restore honor. Okay. I mean, hello.
Yeah.
I mean, and honor is.
And do you remember? Do you remember that little pig-eyed freak delivering that lecture too? About how he's going to bring honor back to Washington D.C.
Well, honor is an expensive thing. Okay, honor is an expensive thing. Having honor, like not torturing people and not committing war crimes and not invading other countries, you see, that's honorable, is to not do those things the way this country used to be. You see, when Nazi Germany invaded Poland and so forth, they lost their honor. okay? And when they lost their honor by committing war crimes, just as the Japanese did, right, there's really only one fate left after that, okay? And in order for, like, you know, the gods that have, you know, cursed the Republicans upon which, you know, all their wishes that they've, the dreams and the prayers that they've done have all now come back to bite them, well, that kind of has to be, you know, like somebody has to hang for that. I'm not saying hang. I'm saying somebody has to be found guilty, okay, or at least tried. At least, let's give it a 9/11 commission whitewashing kind of job. At least we can do that. I mean, heck, we can spend as much as we spent on the 9/11 commission report, and we still wouldn't even come close to how much we spent on Ken Starr and the blowjob and cigars, okay, so...
Yeah, if we don't have $70 million, yeah.
No, you know, we only spent 10 or 11 on the 9/11 commission report. We can spend 10 or 11 investigating. We have to. I mean, thank God he sat there and said all executive orders are frozen. I hope, oh my goodness gracious, I hope when one of the things that he does is open up the presidential records. Oh, you didn't want this out for 70 years? Too bad, it's only 40. You got 5 years left before it's out, or what have you. That would, oh, I would do backflips. And I'll tell you another thing that actually reminds me of something funny and good news. And I woke up to NPR this morning. I had to go run errands all around the frozen tundra out here. You know, you do have to get out there once a month at least, and today was that day. And, you know, I heard on NPR, everybody, all the love me, I'm a liberal NPRites. Anyway, these people are all, you know, sitting there jibber-jabbering about, oh, what we have to face now. And, of course, there's a person from the Council on Foreign Relations on this radio program because it's National Petroleum Radio, isn't it? So this person who, you know, it's the same thing as the Cato or anything, but it represents the controlling powers now. And they're sitting there talking about how we have to do something about Mexico and all these, you know, how they're having all these murders. Yeah, it was at 3,000 or whatever, 80, whoever, how many, you know, they're cutting people off and putting them in drums and wheelbarrows, and it's just hideous and disgusting. But it's part of what happens with this, you know, and they're talking about the war on drugs. Well, this is when my blood starts to boil, because I'm sure you know, in terms of injustices and in terms of waste and in terms of everything, the war on drugs is the most catastrophic failure that I can possibly conceive of because of how far-stretching and how many things that it's actually doing. I mean, the war on drugs is killing the people of this world by poisoning our water because we're spraying fumigants and all these horrible chemicals that last around and stick around forever. And we're sitting here toxifying our water supply that every human being is going to need for as long as we live over this stupid war on drugs, which is basically making nothing but criminals wealthier than they can, and they can have weapons and 50 caliber machine guns and everything else, and they can have more arms and ammunition than the police and the military. Okay, they can buy nuclear submarines and ship their cocaine and all that other stuff, doing the same kinds of things the CIA has been doing for years. And before that, it was the East India Trading Company, and you know how the route of drugs has gone in the just culture of humanity. Now, they're talking about now we have to lock up the border with Mexico, which we can't do because they're our third largest trading partner. And I'm just, and I know you know what I'm going to say, and I know I think it's common sense to me. What's one thing to do with this war on drugs that, you know, we're going to have to deal with as well with Obama? And the only reason I bring this up is because there's a little website out there called change.org. And they've been running these little, you know, what should Obama do?
What's number one on the list? And
exactly.
And we know what was number one, and it quit being number one real fast.
It did, but it's still there. Number three. It's there. Go look. Yeah. It's there. It's hidden, but it's there. Okay, it won. Go look on issues. It's kind of hidden in the site, but it's still there. I checked. Now, that's one thing he needs to do. He needs to do that. Heck, let all the nonviolent criminals out of prison. Nonviolent, okay? Let these people out of prison before we do them any more damage than they could possibly do to themselves.
Yeah, let's get them out of criminal university before they fully matriculate.
Exactly, and really hate us. And, you know, it's like, you know, it was funny, and they're talking about, oh, well, what about Guantanamo? I mean, are some of these people going to hate us so much they're going to come in back?
Oh, see, I saw some pants wetting last night of epically stupid proportions. Some right-winger somewhere said, well, what happens if we catch What happens if we catch Bin Laden, Osama Bin Laden tomorrow? What happens if we catch him? Where will we put him since we're closing Guantanamo? Oh, and, you know, it was one of those reach through the TV moments, Albert, because I wanted to grab her by her scrawny right-wing neck and say, you moron, do you not realize that there is pending and has never been dismissed or disposed of in any justiciable way an arrest warrant for Osama bin Laden? He is a wanted man. What do we do with him without Guantanamo? Well, we do with him what we did with Al Capone or the Unabomber or, you know,
John Gotti. I don't really buy it.
Orange jumpsuit, leg irons, the little steel chain around the waist, the cuffs, the bracelets, to the steel chain around the waist, to the leg irons, and you hobble your criminal, dirty, murderous rear end into a court of competent jurisdiction, and you stand there while representatives of the people of the United States read the indictment against you for your crimes. Mm-hmm. And then you get a trial.
Mm-hmm.
A fair one. Not some kangaroo court trumped up piece of crap in Guantanamo. You get a real one with a real lawyer and real judges. You know, let's not forget that the most hated people in the 13 colonies at one point in time were the people charged in the Boston Massacre. And a man named John Adams stood up and said, I will defend them. It is a fundamental principle and tenet of the criminal law in this country and of the very essence of what we are. That if you are charged with a crime in this country, you have available to you the right against self-incrimination, the right to counsel, the right to a speedy trial, and the right to a jury. And I would not take one of those things away from Osama bin Laden because I want it all done right, and I want the whole wide world to watch.
Right.
And then when the gavel falls,
mm-hmm,
and the judge imposes sentence, and it would be the death penalty.
Rehabilitation.
Well,
it has to be Monday night rehabilitation. We'll bring back.
All the full circle, we're back to Idiocracy. Monday night rehab. But to have the whole world see it and say, look, they're back. Because remember, Spain had that whole train bombing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they caught the rotten, miscreant, criminal bastards who did it. And what did they do? Put them on trial.
The right thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, I don't care. I don't care if Osama, frankly, and this isn't merciful, I don't think. I don't care if Osama plays canasta or pinochle with the Unabomber for the rest of their natural born days.
Yeah.
And every sound they hear is one that's followed by something clanging shut.
Yeah.
I mean, who did we put in Spandau Prison?
Which one?
Albert Speer. I can't remember. One of the Nazi war criminals. It got to where he was the only human being in that prison.
Yeah.
Literally. The whole prison was staffed for him.
Yeah.
And he sort of died in this sort of slow-moving existential nightmare. And that would be fine by me for bin Laden.
Well, see, and that's, and I certainly have to, any of them. I mean, this is for any of them that, you know, you're going to sit there and commit a crime. That's fine. We can certainly, you know, deal with that. And we could certainly, you know, that's why I don't understand why they think.
You're right. But those kangaroo courts at Guantanamo, those things are no way to separate the wheat from the chaff or the terrorists from from literally the goat herders.
No, but you see, here's the thing though. You see, guys like bin Laden and John Gotti and what have you, maybe bin Laden doesn't fit in that guy, but just because, you know, he's more like Bush. Hey, baby girl. He's more like Bush. Okay, because you see, with the Spanish, they get hit with this horrific bombing that we all have video of. You can see, you know, horrible things in the video. You know, when you sit there and you look at a video like that, you know, you can see it. You look at 9/11, you can sit there and see it, and you can sit there and go, okay. And you look at how Spain dealt with it. They brought him to trial. They put him on trial. Boom, boom, boom. The guy, they put him in a probably some old Spanish dungeon that's 8,000 years old, and they locked the cave. Boom. He's in with the Count of Monte Cristo, right? Now, with, you know, over here, what we do is, like, you see, John Gotti, if you offended him, he'd go and he'd kill you. But he wouldn't go and kill your mom and your cousin and their neighbor. And I mean, like, psychopaths do that. You see, so what we got here, that this is, I mean, literally, we've been brought on this psychopathic, socio-freaky path of just rampant murder and destruction, and we have a lot of things to atone for. We have a lot of cleaning up to do, and one of the things that has to be cleaned up is George Bush has to face these charges. There has to be charges, because there are crimes, because there are 100,000 dead people, and we're all bankrupt. And, you know, he wrecked the economy. He can't fix it. He can't pay. He can't do nothing. So there has to be something. You know, Maddow doesn't do it for me. Getting Enron, that doesn't do it for me. These guys are just the, you know, like getting the Tony the Rat or anybody else like that. These guys are like nothing. You know, every other week we're catching the second highest and, you know, Al-Qaeda. You know, we're always catching the second in command or whatever the hell we do that. So, you know, I'm not interested in that. Who the hell? Nobody's interested in that. We're Americans. We're, you know, we're human beings of the 21st century. And, you know, we want the star, you know, and I'll tell you right now, the universe wants Bush. It wants him so bad. You heard, na, 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 na.
Oh, man. Oh, man. Yeah.
Goodbye. I mean, like, Nixon don't even have that. And, you know, I just will say one thing about, you know, everybody's talking about the speech and the saying. Let me say this one thing. You know, everybody, oh, there isn't this word. I actually liked his speech this time because it wasn't a lot of fluff. And I like it real. Give it to me real. I don't mind it real. I can take it. I could take
it. Well, I like the generational theme that he's been working for two or three speeches now. I really, really, I really appreciate that because it has an ability to connect us to something that is fluid and transformative. I like the put away childish things. You know, you can't, again, all things being equal, you can't beat a good Bible verse that 90% of the country recognizes. You know, when I was a child, I spake as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. Bang! See, I mean, it's mnemonic. It's actually mnemonic. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I say, programming. It's, you know, words are emotions, and emotions are part of.
Hey, the bell rang, and I salivated. You know.
There you go. Exactly.
Yeah.
But no, I hear what you're saying, and he has to do that kind of thing. But when we're sitting here looking at. When we're sitting here looking at a speech, you know, I just got to say, you know, that line that everybody, oh, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Well, that was said in a whole sentence, in a whole paragraph. And honestly, I almost missed it the first time I heard it because it's not quite as iconically hit.
Nobody hearing that knew that was an iconic statement because it was sort of wrapped in a whole pastiche of oratory from another era. It's only when it comes out and stands isolated. You could say that about the Kennedy line too, except for the fact that it came as the summation point of an idea. Hey, Albert, I got to run along, brother. I got a bunch of them stacked up, but this has been a great conversation.
Always, brother. Always.
Take care now.
New day, new world. Be good. Bye bye.
Bingo. Later. Onward we go. I hope you guys have hung on. Nope. A little patience here. Nope. Wow. Five lines. Y'all bailed. 14 minutes past the hour. This in from Cindy. What do we do if we catch Bin Laden? We bury him fast because his rotting carcass would really stink. He's been dead for years now. I don't believe it. Nope. Now, look, you want to wander off down that garden path. I can say that, well, I mean, we know from the Tora Bora thing
that he was kept alive. I mean, he just was. For reasons we may not fully understand. And as such, I'm screwing up the phones here, so if I just lost you, please dial back. Wow, they're all lighting up again. You guys. But I don't believe he's dead. And again, I use that hated word, believe. I don't think he's dead. Not that I trust the CIA's voice print analysis, but that I don't think the Bush administration wanted him dead. And as such, I don't think that he is. See how I got to watch myself with that word? Dangerous, dangerous word. I think he's catchable. Or I think he'll at least go down in a gun battle if we make that kind of an effort. But I want him tried. Fair and square. And I want the whole world to see us do it right. Do it honorable. And do it within the framework. Because, there's no caveat. Just like the presidential oath is in the Constitution, but so help me God, isn't. There's no caveat in the Constitution for that you will have the right to a speedy trial unless you attacked buildings with an aircraft. Or you have a right to a trial by jury unless you're a really nasty person. Because you cannot make a cogent, coherent, sane argument that fits within the rest of the framework that is our governmental structure, especially our judicial structure. You can't make a cogent argument that just because you're not an American, you're not entitled to a fair trial. Now, the Bushes argued that, and they paid a lot of lawyers a lot of money to look for that loophole. But when the loophole you find is a loophole because you have literally stretched the letters on the page, you're cheating. And it's as simple as that. I want to return to the rule of law. I want to return to principles of American jurisprudence. And I don't think there's anybody that would not want that. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, it sounds like you had a good trip.
It was a wild trip, David.
Yeah, it sounds. Yeah, I can relate.
I haven't even gotten to the meat of it yet. So yeah, that may have to wait.
Well, I guess you're gonna have to do that either tomorrow, or you'll have to go in extra innings. But I don't think you're gonna do that.
No, I can't do extra innings tonight. I'd fall asleep and bump my head on the microphone.
Yeah, I just wanted to say. I think it's interesting the fact that Bush did not pardon Libby.
It is, but okay, to the same extent that loophole business I was just talking about, David.
Yeah.
I have been turned into a raging paranoid over the last 8 years. We'll take that as given. That's the bottom line. And I don't know what kind of vest pocket pardons there are. I don't know that there's any, there's certainly nothing in the Constitution that says that it has to be published in 3 newspapers.
Mm.
Or anybody has to tell Blitze. It just says the president has the power. Now, since the precedent was established by Gerald Ford in regard to Richard Nixon, that you can pardon a person for crimes with which they have not been charged, then the next, I hate to say logical, but the next step in that incredibly tortured piece of reasoning is that you can pardon people and not tell anybody they have the pardon until they need it. So I don't know what pardons were out there and what ones weren't. I know the fact that Libby was not pardoned, openly. Well, that's really chapped a lot of right-wing rear ends.
I'll give you an interesting bit of detail on that. The word is that a lot of people in D.C. are surprised and shocked in the Cheney's cabinet because they made it clear that they wanted him a public pardon. So that's one of the reasons why I mentioned it. I just thought it was interesting the fact that he didn't get his, that he wasn't on the pardon list.
Yeah.
You have to look at it in the bigger picture. Like, what is it that they hate about, what is it that Bush hates about Libby and Cheney now? There must be.
You know, and I don't think, I think you've touched on something there, David. I don't think that's a love fest.
Oh, exactly. I don't either. I think it's very clear when Bush took on that helicopter, he never wanted to be there. He got pushed in. I don't even think, maybe he didn't even know he was going to win, and he just did it for fun or something. I don't know. He seemed like he did not want to be there. And I always got that feeling that he never wanted to be there. And I don't know. Maybe the most evil thing was this was all a fluke to him.
All right, maybe.
Yeah. And the other.
Yeah. Okay. You'll get the obligatory Star Trek reference. There was something really, really creepy about seeing Dick Cheney pottering around the inauguration like Christopher Pike in his wheelchair. You know, all he was missing was the little panel with three lights. So he goes, beep, boop. Yeah.
The other thing that I wanted to mention, which I think is important, is Tom Hartman touched this on his program, was the issue of the witch hunt of Eric Holder. It's about to take place. That's ongoing right now with Arlen Specter. He said something that was kind of right from inside the Beltway that Eric Holder's one of his best friends. This is really interesting now. One of Eric Holder's, and this will kind of give you the character of this man. It sort of did that to me. I was like, oh, that is interesting. One of Eric Holder's best friends is actually Joe Madison. And that guy's a D.C. talk show legend.
Yeah, so, met him.
Oh, you did meet him?
Yeah.
Okay, well, one of the things that Hartman said was Joe was saying how Eric Holder stopped his car and got out and said and hugged him and said, don't believe anything that you're hearing on this. They're trying to get me right now. He goes, and what you guys need to do is, he goes, I need you guys to call up your senators and let these people know. So I guess that was Madison's message to the people. And to, I mean, that was Holder's message to Madison and to the.
Well, a little bit of inside skinny that I also got along the way, and I'm not going to, frankly, I can't remember who said it.
Yeah.
But the other part of the Holder drama has to do, and this has to do with Arlen Specter, it has to do with who is threatening to run against Arlen Specter in the primary, the Republican primary against him again. The same creepy right wing. For Roland tongue speaking goober who ran the last time, you know, the ones who think, just a real weird, and the guy's name's Toomey. And Specter is having to respond to Toomey indirectly, or else, you know, because it basically, Specter's being handed an ultimatum that he, you know, that he marches to the hard right wing tune a little bit, or he'll have another hellacious primary fight on his hand, because the Specter had a hell of a hard time the last time with this guy. And that's the last thing Arlen Specter wants. I mean, these people do have to, no matter how flawed the system is and how much the money corrupts, and absolute money corrupts absolutely, they have to run for election. And that was the conventional wisdom that was conveyed to me, is that this isn't about Eric Holder nearly as much as it is about Arlen Specter playing to the bleachers, you know, the bleacher bums in the hardcore uber weird right wing of Pennsylvania politics.
Well, you know, that's exactly what Hartman was getting at with the Arlen Specter, and he was pretty much hitting home that to call your senators in reference that you are for the appointment of Eric Holder, and you want it to go through because you want to see prosecution for war crimes for this administration, or along the lines of that. So I kind of hope there won't be that much friction regarding that, because I really want to get to, well, let's be honest, we want to get to other issues. We just want to move them out one after the other.
Well, that's what I keep getting at. There's so much work to be done in the next 2 years. People tend to think in terms of presidential terms, but there is 2 years to get a lot of this stuff done.
I got to tell you, I've been disappointed by a few things, not with the actions of Obama's signing statements and like that. To me, that's just a given. That's what he's expected to do with the closing of Gitmo. That's what I thought. Just expected off the board, just to reverse everything. But one of the things that really surprised me, it just made me go. I'm always about momentum and rhythm. If you guys look at I'll plug the board now. If you guys look at headonradionetwork.com/forum, you'll see a few new posts, and I'm trying to do that every day. But really, the truth is, I should have at least 20 or 10 to 15 posts a day, that kind of thing. I think I have 10. But the point is that I don't see, I hope the Obama administration is listening. I noticed they put up the White House Gov site. Great, bravo, welcome. You did a transition, great. But there isn't any blog post. There's like one. And it's like, this is important, because when you go silent on that, other people are going to go everywhere. They're going to go to the blogs. You're going to lose that momentum.
I know, David. And the fact of the matter is, I am guilty guy number one where our blog is concerned.
I'm talking about, I'm not talking about yours. I'm talking about a paid position here. I understand from where you're coming from. What you do every night, that's your meta blogging, okay? What you do every night on the radio. What I'm talking about is something completely different. I'm talking about the guy in charge of the White House blog. I'll put him on blast. His name is Macon Phillips.
Okay. I lost you here for a minute. Yeah.
Yeah, he should have more posts, Bob. This is ridiculous. If this is your job and you're in charge of a blog and you have things going on every day, guess what? I know a hip hop blog that posts 20 times a day. Get with it. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Okay. Sure.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that gets to me, because it's like some of these people who are blogging aren't even paid, and what is it? They set up a Twitter, and you're supposed to be active on that thing too, and they haven't posted for like 24 hours. This is what I'm talking about, momentum.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's important. You can't do it.
And frankly, the people who do it best are going to be the people who win this battle. Now, the one good thing about this is that I have seen no evidence whatsoever to suggest that the Republicans are anywhere near figuring any nearer figuring out the Twitter than they are figuring out the Google.
But if you wait around
saying, "Wow, we don't have to worry about that," because you know they're still working on tying their shoelaces, you may find out in a year or so that the shoelaces they've tied have steel-toed boots on the end of them. So it's get out ahead and stay ahead. There's two ways to run for office. Unopposed and scared to death.
From my point, it has to do with the fact that if we're going to have that change brand, and we're going to have a new dawning of America, and we're going to have that it's go from day one, that blog should be active with all news all the time. I don't care. Post every 5 hours at the very least.
There's good. Yeah, I mean, it's
job, Bob.
It's not like you're down in the basement in your pajamas and you don't have anything to write about. No, I get
it,
Dave.
That's what I'm saying. You know what gets me is the excuses of a lot of these blogs, a lot of these pages, a lot of these sites, and it takes nothing to post up something. If you're in administration, for God's sakes, you have written press releases right there sitting on your table.
Yeah.
You can
just
paste it in. Videos.
Then maybe you got to bring some, and this is the other side of it, because anybody who has ever tried to run a discussion board that got any traffic at all knows that once you open the damn thing up, you got to spend, there's an entirely separate job just clearing out the right wing filth.
Well, the thing with, I'm talking about, see, the White House gov blog, they decided to go closed circuit, so you just post. No one leaves any comments.
Yeah.
So the thing that gets me is the fact that it's losing momentum. I know people don't see the bigger picture, but believe me, I was on one of the biggest websites on the internet. I was a charter member, and I helped build the momentum and the rhythm. And it took a while. And if you take those gaps and spaces, they mean a lot. That's why I'm staying on that board, Bob, because I know I want someone else to start posting, and I appreciate the FKPS and Thunderstone and people like that. But when I see 80 views on something and I don't see a reply on something, it kind of, like I said, not angry. Like my
no, but okay, yeah. Wait. Let's take a moment with that, David.
Yeah.
Don't necessarily get frustrated with that.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is because I've seen your work, and I've seen the writings of others.
Yeah.
And it goes back to the fact that this radio network has a host of brilliant individuals who are out there and are beginning to move into posting their thoughts. But one of the things that I have always sort of always been the downside of a blog to me is this. And I said this to Guy James yesterday. There's an element to a blog that is and this is not a criticism. I know a lot of people love the format. I just don't.
Yeah.
I prefer message boards, frankly, because then there's an ongoing, for some reason or other, it facilitates an ongoing dialogue, whereas blog posting, for the most part, is everybody typing their idea and moving on, and no dialogue happens. For the most part, you know, I'd say in the majority of blogs, it's very, hey, look at me, I can type, or driven.
I understand what you're saying.
And to that end, when you see a good idea, if you're getting a bunch of views but not necessarily a bunch of responses, that's not an indication of failure of the post. It's an indication of the fact that, yeah, okay, that information has been taken, processed, absorbed, and next idea.
Yeah.
Because frankly, the people in this network put a lot of ideas out there, both written and verbal, or vocal, and I mean, Lord God, I could be on the air, David, until 2 o'clock this morning, just doing stuff that's happened in the 2 days I haven't been behind a microphone.
Oh, exactly. I mean, the thing that just gets me is the fact that we have three people posting on the forum, and it has to do with the view count.
Yeah.
And I see views like 80 views. It's almost baffling. Like, when does it start when people post? I don't really have an answer.
Yeah, get in there, jump in there, and don't be shy. That's all we can say.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. And but going back to the broader issue of the fact of somebody who has the infrastructure, like the White House, my point of pointing this out, hopefully these people are listening, is the fact they go elsewhere and they'll get the news misconstrued, or they'll get confused. If you do a great job, hell, Bob, if they do a great job, they could get blogging awards on the WhiteHouse.gov.
And while I despise Karl Rove, I do agree with one tenet that he put out there at one point, and I thought it was worth absorbing and assimilating and processing.
Yeah.
And that is, if you're explaining, you're losing.
If you're explaining, you're losing. I agree with that too.
You know, get your idea out there first, because there are communications tenets out there, and one of them are the rules of primacy and recency. You retain what you heard first, and you retain what you've heard most recently. So that primacy is carved in stone, whereas recency is a constantly evolving fluid thing. But but if you're there first with the idea, then everybody is responding and less so. Yeah, I agree with the general point you're making overall. David, we're stacked up, and I'm going to roll along, but very, very good observation.
Not a problem, Bob. Talk to you later.
Hey, and thanks for your work on the forums. I do appreciate it.
All right, no
we
problem.
We all do. Later. All right, later.
All right, bye.
That's David, our pop culture correspondent from Maine. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/forums is where you need to go. Get in there. Participate. It's lively, and it's fun. All right, let's keep trying. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how you doing, man?
Hey, Gary, what's happening, man?
No, not much, not much. Just thinking about the situation that's going on in the country right now, the passage of this new day into the, you know, into this new light or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And it's like we're grabbing for hope or dragging the criminals into the future with us. You know what I mean? Kind of, it's like, what do you do here? You know, so it's kind of like, you know, I think action's all tied together. So I think you have to, start to consider strongly, all the dirt, dig through all that dirt and the crimes and, you know, put that back together and prosecute where you can so you know, we can build this thing the right way. And I don't think there's really any way around it. I mean, so, you know, we'll see what happens, but I hope that people don't think that they can build this house foundation without, you know, cementing some of the crimes that have been done in the past. You know what I mean?
It's absolutely critical. And yesterday at the Progressive Media Summit, that question was raised, and I have to say, to be candid with everyone listening, there was not a satisfactory answer offered. It simply was not. There was a lot of fairly concrete stuff put forward on other issues, but when it got around to the idea of accountability, not so much.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. I think they're doing that dance. I mean, how do we go into this bright, hopefully bright future and still deal with all that dirt and stuff that's, you know, dealing in the past, you know, it's like,
yeah, because you don't want to walk into the 5-star restaurant with mud on your shoes.
There you go. I'm trying to find some analogy, and maybe later on I'll put up a topic based on this, you know, to help the issue that Dave was talking about. Because if we somehow develop some software that can just process our thoughts.
Yeah, you mean brain to keyboard minus the fingers?
Yeah, because that's a problem. A lot of people private. You know, they might not even want to register on the form.
Oh, I know. There's that, and I'm the worst in the world about it. I'll write a paragraph, and then my editing gene kicks in, and I'm an hour editing the stinking paragraph before I finish the idea. Writing is hell for me. I love to do it, but I'm also so confounded, obsessive, compulsive, Gary.
Yeah.
That I, you know, to the extent that I can make it cogent and make it say exactly what I want it to say, I'm really hard on myself.
Yeah, I'm actually a little bit more looser now. I'm like, if the general idea is there, you know, because sometimes I post on other forums and people come back and says, you know, they'll correct my spelling and all this other stuff. And I'm like, you know, if you're on a forum and you're into, like, you know, correcting people's spelling, you know, people are just kind of free flowing. You don't know if they're on a BlackBerry. You don't know where they are, what they're using. It's like, man, if you know the general idea, you know, get over the detail. You know, you're an
idiot.
You know, it's like, come on. I hope my ideas are strong enough that you'll.
Well, a lot of times when you see the grammar Nazis come out, you know, you're winning.
Well, that's true, too.
Or what Joe Vecchio used to refer to as the concern trolls. Well, I'm concerned that you've said that a little too strongly. You know you're winning.
Oh, man.
You're winning.
Yeah, I want to jump back right quick to something you talked about the other day, a couple of days ago.
Sure.
Heard a rebroadcast because I've been kind of working the hours that your show is on, so I haven't been able to really listen to the network, you know, last 2 or 3 months. You were talking about whether African Americans feel like, I think there was some poll.
Yeah, that was Monday night. That was the CNN opinion research survey that said two-thirds of African Americans feel like or believe that King's dream has been realized by virtue of the election and inauguration of Barack Obama.
Okay. Well, that depends on how that question is asked. Because being an African American myself, I've talked to a lot, maybe a couple hundred so far, because, you know, I was at the inauguration out there in the mall and just talking to people in general. And the consensus is one person has reached the mountaintop. And there's a lot more that need to get there.
It's not even necessarily about getting to the mountaintop. It's about getting out of the swamp.
Yeah.
Getting up on dry ground.
Exactly. That's what most African Americans feel. That, okay, one got out. One is there. You know, I mean, in general, and just And it's like, look, but nobody thinks that, you know, this is, we're all better off right now. I don't get that feeling at all. And, you know, so I don't know what CNN and all these other people are trying to, these opinion makers are trying to paint. Oh, racism is over.
That's exactly what they're doing, Gary. That's exactly what they're doing.
They could do that, but reality don't give a damn about that. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, they don't. Reality. But they don't truck around a lot in reality. I mean, we're talking about a so-called chattering class here that would no sooner have been caught dead riding the metro like I was Tuesday evening than they would have flown to the moon. You know, CNN's John King does not ride public transit. Me, I feel like, hey, look at me. I'm all public. I'm riding the transit. But, you know, not Wolf Blitzer.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also this whole thing about they kind of have this. The media is always so aloof to me because you look at them and they're laughing about things. And you're like, wow, you got a great job. You know, you don't really feel the pain of the American people. And it always comes out in the things where they're talking now where there was no, you know, there's no iconic, memorable line of that speech, and they're all criticizing the speech and all this other kind of stuff. And I'm like, you have so many serious issues here, and they're sitting there making this speech as though it's like, I don't know how to say it. It's like, it's like some teacup party or something. Or
yeah, they're parsing it like some sort of dadgum soliloquy when it was not rendered to be art, but was rendered to be literally an address to the nation.
Exactly. Right on the money. But that's basically, yeah, they're sitting there trying to edit it. It's like they're doing what they always do, is trying to create what they want to create.
For once, Gary, I resent the fact that they are judging this, or at least appear to be judging this speech in a vacuum. Because just as we said during the election cycle, that the election was not between Barack Obama and the perfect president, that it was between Barack Obama and John McCain, so too, this speech was not to be, it was not a speech to be gauged against the most soaring oratory of human invention. I mean, dang, I sat in a Latin class wishing in college I could build a time machine so I could go back and murder Cicero in his cradle, okay? And he was the most stunning, stirring oratory of the Roman Republican era. And I hated it. It was terrible. I mean, brilliant ideas, but... And to that end, the judgment, frankly, the judgment in the organic whole of the time in which we live, the judgment of Barack Obama's inaugural speech is not against FDR or JFK or Grover Cleveland, for heaven's sakes. The judgment of Barack Obama's inaugural address is against the two inaugural addresses that immediately preceded him that were given by that pig-eyed little lout who could barely speak the language. That's and if you make that judgment, Gary, well, then Barack Obama achieves the gold standard, while, you know, dim leaders, little pieces of babbling, wind up on the same par with the sound of cheap silverware hitting pavement.
Yeah. Well, isn't it the thing that I thought there was one line to me that stood out when it says, what he said something about a nation cannot prosper when it only rewards the prosperous or something to that degree.
And like I said, the put away childish things thing, because that put away childish things line, that was, you know, that wasn't for folks who don't have a job.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't for folks who are struggling to keep the lights on or feed their families. That was a line that was sent with a barb on the end of it straight into the heart of Sean Hannity and Flush Flembaugh and O'Reilly and Laura Ingraham and all of those miserable hate meisters. You know, the biggest, frankly, the biggest confirmation of the effect of the speech was given by Flush Flembaugh when he said, I hope he fails, because he understands what's at stake here. I've got an email that came in here from our buddy Mara, and she said Rush wants Obama to fail because if Obama succeeds, Rush has nothing to bitch about that even his moron listeners would buy. And that means bye-bye Rush.
Yeah.
And she is absolutely correct.
Yeah, I have a right-wing crazy nut bag comes on here. He's on the same station, radio station here locally in D.C., Maryland. You know, the only reason why I listen to him because they do allow a lot of, you know, a contrary point of view. And you get, you know, so, and it's 6:30 a.m. And the guy, he was going off and he was talking about, you know, the first thing he was talking about was about Obama. The first thing out the gate, they were like, you know, I want Obama to fail, not as an American. In other words, he wanted to be successful on some things, but he wants him to fail at others. And they were trying to figure out how to do this because what was happening, it was coming across as if Obama isn't successful, then America isn't successful. So he realized he had to try to backtrack and say, no. I want him to be successful protecting America, but I don't want him to be successful with his policies. So, you know, he didn't come out and say for the corporations, but you know what I'm saying. So he had to try to backtrack because what was happening, even some of his right wing, whatever, was saying, wait a minute, man. You know, the guy's the president now. We're in serious trouble here. You can't be going around saying, well, we want Obama to fail. If Obama fails, we're in trouble because George Bush has failed. And, you know, so you can't just keep going down that line. And that's the thing now that they're struggling with. How do we attack Obama, but yet say we're still pro-American? You know what I mean? And they're struggling with that right now.
They're in a bind, and they're dealing with that wing of the party that I mentioned earlier that thinks that they get better by get well again by getting weirder. And, you know, I welcome them to do that. I want them to get absolutely carpet-chewing crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Because then Eisenhower's own prophecy comes true. He wrote that letter in the 50s and said any political party that proposes to end Social Security will cease to be a national party. He didn't say in a week, in a year, or in a month, but he said it will happen. And to that end, you know, they proposed an end to Social Security in 2004. And the rest of all the stuff that Eisenhower understood was just a swirling poop storm is following after them now. And frankly, I want the Republican Party, as we know it, dead and gone.
Well, that's why I'm going to get back to the original point is why it's very important that Obama, and I said this before, I was not going to criticize him. I know everybody's been kind of making hay in light of his picks and making probably like, you know, he's doing this and that. I said I was not going to criticize him. So he actually got power and actually could do something to me because everything before this right now, he was just, you know, playing his card hand and not showing his cards. He's going to start showing his cards it's probably take another 60 days. But after the next 60 days, you're going to start seeing the real cards because we got to dig through that mess and blah, blah, blah. And my one big criticism immediately will be out the gate. He must prosecute war criminals, period. You have to dismantle the Republican Party for the crimes they have done. If he fails to do that, that will be the biggest mistake of his administration. And I'll be right there at the front of the gate as a person who supported Obama and say, look, it's time to do the right thing and prosecute people. It is critical that they do that. And we got to build some kind of momentum behind it because everybody in the media is going to tell them about it. And you know this, we all say, don't do it. They're setting it up now because they know that their corporate scoffers and all those other people are not going to benefit from it too. And that's the thing that we got to counteract. We cannot not let the media, you know, they're just trying to feed it to you. Oh, you can't do it. You can't do it because, you know, we want to be positive. We want to move forward. I'm like, I don't mind moving a little slower forward if I can get Bush in there. You know what I mean?
Worth the wait.
Exactly. There you go, man.
Hey, Gary, it's good to hear from you, brother. Did you? I hope you didn't freeze too bad out there.
No, but I had some people, you know, we were out there. I just want to ask you one quick thing. Did you notice when Bush was, it was real cold early in the morning, but, you know, it kind of warmed when the sun came out. But did you notice that when Bush, when they mentioned his name, did you get this sense that on those trons, there was some kind of sound effect thing to make the claps louder?
I didn't because I wasn't there physically, and B, I didn't get to see it on video. This was all stuff that I heard
on the radio as I was heading to the airport.
Yeah, when he came out and announced his name, I literally could hear the sound effect. Because I was watching people in the crowd. You know, some people were clapping, probably military and stuff like that. But there was an audible sound, like they enhanced the audio to make the crowd noise sound louder.
Oh, look, you know, I'm sure there were shotgun mics involved, and you know, whoever's engineering can run that audio up if they feel the need to.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, just something I know.
Yeah, and you know what? From the guy who wore the square box inside his suit coat at the debate 4 years ago, that crowd will do anything they can to cheat. So it would not surprise me in the least.
There was something going on with that. I noticed that when I was watching it out there. But anyway, man, I'll let you go, man. I'll probably catch you guys next week because I know you're gonna have a lot of people over the next couple of days.
I got a lot of catching up to do. This was two days gone that felt like 2 weeks.
Okay, yeah, we got to start building the momentum now to get Bush in them.
Yeah, we do, and we got momentum to build on a lot of on some other topics too.
Okay, all right. You should be getting something from me soon.
All right, take care, Gary. Thanks a lot. Bye. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.
My buddy Gary in Maryland. And, you know, we will have time as the days go on for your stories of if you were there or wherever you were, of what it felt like and how you feel now and what does have to be job one. You know, bring those to the table. Hey, John.
Hey, mate, how are you? First, I got to tell you that picture you sent to me yesterday and to a few of us from D.C., I sent it off to Gail at work, and the reply that I got was, Mr. Kincaid goes to Washington, which I thought was rather cool. But I want to talk about this whole oath botch thing, which I kind of found interesting because, unfortunately, you were traveling while I was hosting the party in the chat room, which we had a ball.
Yeah, I wanted to know about that. That must have been a hoot.
Oh yeah, we had a great time, and as soon as I fired up, it suddenly didn't feel like 3 a.m. my time. But you know, when Roberts botched the oath, you know, I automatically knee-jerk went, that little son of a bitch. He wanted to screw up the moment, didn't he? Right. Well, I kind of take that all back, because the reports are straight afterwards, he went up to Obama and was just like, I am so sorry. And it was on his call that he showed up at Obama's office yesterday to redo it. And I told you in chat, I don't think you got to mention it on air, that Jonathan Turley said that he is the third president to actually retake the oath because of some sort of goof. And the way the law actually reads is at noon on January 20th, the new government takes over whether they have taken the oath or not.
Exactly.
So the end of the argument. It's the end of the argument as far as Fox News should be concerned. Get over it. It's not an issue. Get over it. Forget about it. Shut the hell up.
And, you know, that was pointed. Chris Wallace just embarrassed himself with all that garbage. But you know the other part of it, I was listening on the radio when it happened, and I was going, "Don't!" And
oh yeah,
but what did happen? The next break was somewhere along the way. It was before the oath happened. Whoever the NPR coverage was, I forget. I think it may have been Michelle Norris. At about 12:04, when the next break came, she said, "Well, we're running a little bit, you know, because, I guess commentary for an inaugural is like doing commentary for a golf match or something, because you kind of got to talk like this." And she said, "Well, we are at 4 minutes past 12 o'clock, and we're running a little bit behind, and the oath has not yet been administered. But I should note here that regardless of the fact that the oath has not been administered, George W. Bush is no longer president of the United States." And I looked at Agnes and I said, God, that just makes me feel good.
Oh, yeah. It, you know, I mean, we all have all our mixed reservations and all that kind of stuff. But I got to say, the guys hit the ground running on some things in ways that I actually wasn't quite expecting as of yet. And one of the things that impressed me most was the very, very first international call he made was to Abbas.
Yeah, that was freighted with just a little bit of symbolism, wasn't it?
Right, and I, you know, Gail even said, you know, too bad he didn't ring Hamas, but I said, you know, Hamas might not be right at the other end of a telephone, it might be a little harder to get a hold of them.
Yeah, they're having infrastructure problems right now.
Yeah, but it was definitely a bit of symbolism, and the fact that he made the statement to the Muslim world that this is the dawn of a new time where we're going to work together on, common interests and common motives or whatever it was. There were two things in the address that I found really stunning. First of all, it's the first president to actually mention Islam or Muslims in an inaugural address.
Right.
And the other one was when he said, when he actually mentioned my folks, the non-believers. And Lawrence O'Donnell said he was out in the crowd when that line came by, and he said that he looked around and he saw a whole bunch of people's heads kind of whip around and look at each other like, did he actually just say that? And he said, I took that to mean there were a few people saying, does inclusion really go that far? And I was sitting there going, yes, inclusion goes that far. Thank you very much, Mr. President.
It's not, and the thing is, it's not such a, what, I heard it, I thought it was and it was right. And frankly, you know, if you heard David Silverman on the program a week ago, I guess it was a week ago last Monday, you know, he pointed out the Obama campaign came to them. And that was acknowledgement owed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I know that got so far up, you know, certain aspects of the population. But you know what? Good. Good. And, you know, and it was funny, you know, sometimes when you're broadcasting during these moments, the speech sometimes does kind of go like past you a bit because you're concentrating on so many other things, the chat room, everything else. And it wasn't until later in the day when I sat back and actually started watching replays that I really saw how many direct punches Obama took at Bush while he was right behind him. I thought it was beautiful.
Yeah, sit there and take it. Sit there and take it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the whole thing about the notes from Bush to Obama, that's tradition. Every exiting president has always left a note at the desk or in the desk for the new president. And that's where that classic note from Reagan to Bush 41, where he said, don't let the turkeys get you down. That was in that note. That has been something that's been tradition for decades. It might even be since, you know, almost the beginning of the nation.
Okay. Well, I guess I can live with that. But the idea that Bush wrote anything...
Oh, I know.
Still strikes me as entirely fraudulent.
But I'll tell you, speaking of writing things, and here, you know, the Australian media has gotten really, really up my what's this the last couple of days. First of all, they had on the headline of the Sydney Morning Herald yesterday that Obama flubs oath, when it was already known that it was actually Justice Roberts.
Well, that was at least apparent to me, and maybe it's because I've read it in the Constitution, you know, silly little pamphlet. I read it from time to time. But it was apparent to me, listening to it, that it was Roberts' screw-up. But, I mean, the words were barely out of either one of them's mouths before the right-wing bloviation machine started its filth spray all over the country. I mean, from the weirdo little wingnut here in Beckley to Laura Ingraham to Chris Wallace, they're desperate. That really was the mark. That was a sign of desperation.
Oh, no doubt. And if you had been able to watch him, you go and watch the video, you can actually see Obama looking at him like, "You sure you got that right, mate? You sure about that? I'm a constitutional legal scholar and was a professor. You sure you got that right, man?" And, you know, and the thing that I thought was funny is, you know, here's Robert. He's kind of a young guy. This is the first time he's ever doing it. And I can't remember the name of the guy that gave Biden his oath. But the old guy, the older experienced guy that did the oath with the vice president, had it on a little cue card or a piece of paper in front of him because, obviously, in the moment, it's a huge moment. Anybody can screw up.
Yeah, sure.
In in hindsight, I even had the raw, I even had a knee jerk reaction at the time and went and blasted Roberts. I actually think he wanted it to be picture perfect visually and didn't want to be reading off a card. And in the moment, he choked.
Yeah, he did choke. Well, and let me throw this one other little observation your way, John, see what you think. You have pointed out that Obama is a constitutional scholar. He is a lawyer, and he is a lawyer of high repute, you know, first African-American editor of the Harvard Law Review, among other things. This is not some meat and potatoes street lawyer who does bail bond hearings, okay? Although that wouldn't necessarily be bad either. And you and I have referred to, in the course of the election night coverage and so forth, what I have taken to thinking of as the Obama-Wan Kenobi mind trick, the Jedi mind trick as practiced by Obama-Wan Kenobi. And that was one I got to thinking about, and that was one of those little moments, John. That was a moment where the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, who is basically lawyer number one in the country, bar none, okay, he's the chief. I mean, he's the chief. He's head of the whole the judicial branch. And here's an incoming president who corrects him. New sheriff in town. You're my first notch.
Yep. You know, the whole Holder thing, it was very interesting what I heard you and David talking about, because, you know, I do find it interesting that they're really making the big stand on Eric Holder. And, yeah, I think that there are political motivations as far as fundraising. You know, they need a rallying cry right now. All they have is Al Franken and Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton, the Hillary Clinton one, isn't even as powerful as it once was now that she's Secretary of State and that she got, you know, pretty well across the board support. And I, not being a Hillary fan, I actually have some fairly high expectations for her in that job.
I think she's going to get it right within the context of sort of middle of the road centrist politics in this country, which is not where I am. And I acknowledge that. But I think she will get it right in those terms.
Yep, I do too.
You know, we were walking, like I said, the best possible tour guide you could ever have in Washington, D.C. is Guy James. And so he walked me around the Russell Senate office building, and it's the most beautiful of the three Senate office buildings because it's that same gorgeous Roman, Roman style, and it was, you know, Depression era building. You know, we were in hard, hard times, and we built buildings that spoke to our aspirations. And, you know, thank heaven for that, because I hate concrete block architecture. But anyway, he's walking, and we walk down one hall, and lo and behold, what you'll have is you'll have a state flag, an American flag outside the main door of a Senate office. And then, you know, the reserved offices that go with that office, but that's the one that's open. We walked past one door that was Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama. I kind of muttered under my breath to Guy, waste of space. And we walk another 30 feet, and on the other side of the hall, there's Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama. And I muttered under my breath a little bit louder, waste of air. And that's where these people are, and they've got, that's all they have. The power, especially with regard to the Senate of the United States, the power that the Republicans have is the power that Harry Reid gives them. And that's kind of sad to say, but they can be told to sit down and shut up, because just because they're in the minority doesn't mean that they don't, you know, they complain about pork and earmarks and stuff during a political campaign. But if you do your homework, you find out that the Republican Party brought home more pork when it was in the majority than the Democrats ever dreamed of. And they're going to be wanting stuff. And if you negotiate from a position of strength, things change dramatically.
Oh, yeah. And it appears that the GOP is also on a big rebuild the K Street project thing now.
Yeah, I saw that.
And did you see the bit? This, I thought this was interesting, and it's just so unbelievably tragic that this crap happens, that the Army is suing KBR?
No, no, I didn't.
12 Army officers and one contractor have been killed by faulty electrical work over in Iraq. And basically what they've been doing is using unlicensed, underqualified, non-English-speaking electricians to put in, you know, water systems and other things. And I think it was like on the 12th of January, maybe it was the 2nd of January, a young Army officer came into contact with a pump that electrocuted him and put him into cardiac arrest straight away. And KBR's response whenever someone would complain about the shoddy work was, occupational health and safety doesn't exist over here. If you don't like it, go home.
Yeah. And they also they also pled, it was either KBR or Halliburton one, pled that Sharia law should take precedence in any case arising from Iraq. Because apparently they found a loophole or something.
Oh, my. Oh, my. And if you haven't seen it yet, you got to check out this NSA guy on Countdown last night.
Oh, I did see that. Guy and I were sitting there watching that, winding down after a long day when we got back from dinner.
I mean, I think it's just going to be out of the woodwork, because, you know, he was pretty clear. He was afraid to really come out until the Bush administration was gone, and it makes complete sense. So I think the floodgates are not just slowly opening. I think that they're going to just kind of open up over the next couple of months.
Yeah, full on spillway action.
Yeah, because now the retribution that these people feared isn't there. And, you know, Obama's made statements and other things that he signed on recently about, you know, the idea of justice. And these are things that I just love to hear. Justice. Not retribution, but justice.
Yeah, and not dummied up justice. The constitutional
right.
justice. Because anything that calls itself justice that is not rooted in the Constitution and the principles embodied therein is engaging in flummery.
No kidding. With that, Bob, I'm going to go because I'm in the midst of heaps of work on the website.
Yeah, I know you are. I kind of hate to take you away from that, but I saw a couple of your emails while I was gone, and that's stunning stuff that's going to be happening to the site.
Yeah. I'm really excited. I mean, aside from our admins, folks really can't see what's going on yet, but it'll start to become visible over the next couple of days as I run through all my checks. But yeah, it's really starting to come together, and you know, I think David's going to be really, really impressed with what we're doing because all facets of the site, forum, blogging, community messaging groups, the whole bit, it's all going to be intertwined, and we're really going to be able to, you know, it's going to be a real activist working hub. This is what I'm trying, this has been the plan for over a year, and it's finally coming true.
And, you know, there's nothing like, what did Edison say? I'm a firm believer in luck, and I find the harder I work, the more I have of it. This has been a whole bunch of hard work on your part, and we certainly do appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to it because, you know, bringing together that integrated whole is simply it enhances everything that we're doing on air so much. Me, you, Guy, it's stunning.
And so, anyway, man, I'm glad you're back. Glad you got to D.C. back and safe, and your story with the homeless guy was just brilliant. I mean, that's humanity right there. And I, you know, I've been shown more grace by people with nothing at times in my life, and it sometimes, you know, just really blows me away.
Yeah, I know. I couldn't get it off my mind. Obviously, I still can't get it off my mind. And I just. That guy was worried about me.
Yeah, sometime remind me to tell you the PATH train story.
Okay, sounds good. John, we'll talk soon.
All right, man, take care.
Later.
Bye-bye.
If you haven't figured it out, obviously we're going to extra innings, at least until I've cleared out the boards here. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, good evening, Bob.
Hey, Ed.
How was your take off from the airport over there.
Oh, you know, Beckley International's a lovely little airport. I like it a lot.
I'm sorry?
I said it's a lovely little airport. And it's got, I like its runway much better than Charleston's, frankly.
That takeoff, though, were you surprised at the sudden drop?
Oh, no, not at all, because it's much more profound going off the top of that hill at Yeager in Charleston.
I haven't been off that one, but this one over here, when that airplane takes over that runway and drops like it does, I wasn't too comfortable with that, but of course that was my first flight. But I'm glad you're back, glad you're sound, and I had some comments here. One is, and I hope I'm not confused on Guantanamo Bay or Gitmo, whatever the
same thing.
Proper name for it is. We called it Guantanamo Bay when I was in the Navy, and we sailed all around that. But they seem to make a big thing out of the people that's in there. And, you know, and probably you'll disagree part of what I have to say, but the people that they haven't got anything on, that they're just holding there, on the potential of them being dangerous and with no proof at all, I think they should turn those people loose. And the other one is, if those other people have proven to kill Americans or harmed Americans, then I think they should put them before a damn firing squad. Just that simple.
Well, I'm with you. I'm with you on part one, Ed. I'm not on part two. Because because this is a nation founded on laws, and we don't just put people in front of firing squads.
No, I'm not talking about just arbitrarily taking them out. I'm talking about, and I don't even agree with the military form of justice. And this,
right, they are deserving. They are deserving of a complete legal and judicial process, just like we would afford any other criminal defendant.
And that's what I'm for. And I'm talking about then, if they're found guilty, then give them the same treatment that they would. But you don't turn them kind of people loose to go right back and organize and form other groups that will eventually kill some of us, or we have to kill them eventually anyway. So why turn them loose? But, and you're right. I'm not talking about just going in there and yanking them up with a shirt collar and say, let's go, it's your turn. I'm not for that. But I'm not for turning that type of person loose anyway. They should have a, and somebody should recognize the fact, I know your government property when you're captured like that, your government property when you take the oath to go into service. You can be arrested for fighting and hurting one another while you're in the service. And I know what I'm talking about on there. I've been there. And, but I'm not for the military way of handling combatants like that.
Well, and see, that's the essential rub, Ed, is the fact that, A, we don't know who from what. Some of the facts that we do know are that that in the earliest days of the Afghanistan campaign, the United States had a bounty. And we would turn any Afghan into a man wealthy beyond his wildest dreams. We were paying up to $5,000 for folks to rat out their neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say you had a dispute over a goat with your next door neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all you had to do was turn him into the Americans, and they'd swoop him up, and you didn't have a goat problem anymore.
Yeah. And he may not have any kind of problem at all anymore because of the way the American soldiers have treated those people over there, because it appears to me that in a lot of cases it didn't make a lot of difference where they pointed their guns.
Right, and the next thing is, how do we define the so-called enemy combatant status? Okay, neither Afghanistan nor Iraq ever fielded an army against us. All right, so nobody came out in uniforms. These are all guys walking around in their what passes for street clothes over there. And so we just term them enemy combatant as opposed to prisoner of war. You know, we've got an American kid literally a young man named John Walker Lind, who is in prison in the United States for a significant portion of what remains of his adult life. And he was tried and pled guilty because he was facing penalties that he could never have gotten out from under. And the evidence against him was so ginned up, and his lawyer wasn't even allowed to see the evidence against him. Okay? Now, take all that into consideration when you consider that this young man went to Afghanistan and Pakistan. Well, he went to Pakistan. He had converted to Islam and a radical version of it, and went to Pakistan to train to fight in the disputed Kashmir region, which would have meant fighting Indian nationals, not Americans. But then when we started the war against Afghanistan, and let there be no mistake that we started that war just like we did Iraq, then they were diverted. And the next thing you know, it's, well, he's an enemy combatant against the United States. Well, we, you know, there's a history of Americans going abroad to fight in wars, Ed. What was it called in the Spanish Civil War? Was it the Abraham Lincoln Brigade that a lot of Americans signed up for and went to fight on the fight against the fascists in Spain? Well, under the terminology that the Bush and the standards the Bush administration used, those Americans would have been deemed enemy combatants.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you go, you know, it don't take much to, and you got me a little bit off of my train of thought, but when I hear these statements made like, well, they killed so-and-so over there. Or, you know, well, what the hell are we doing over there to start with? They wouldn't have been killed. What would we do if they were in our backyard? And that's the part that drags on my mind heavy.
And see,
those people wouldn't have been killed. The hornet's nest wouldn't have been stirred up. If like you call him, that little snake-eyed bastard hadn't started that stuff in Iraq to start with. So,
and you see, there's so much, and what Gary mentioned a couple of minutes ago is so very true. There must be backward-looking inquiries into where we screwed up, because if you don't look at your screw-ups and examine them, you'll make the same mistake again sooner or later. And we don't want to ever do this again. Of course, we said that about Vietnam, too.
We will. You know, the same symptoms of depression have already... we've already experienced that. We're doing the same thing, cutting wages, stockpiling the goods, and nobody to buy them. You know, we never learn, Bob. You know, give it two generations, and we'll do the same thing. But I wanted to comment too on.
Let me just throw one thing at you, because this idea of looking back and not repeating our mistakes. We must remember that before the first bomb fell on Afghanistan, and George started a war against Afghanistan before he started a war against Iraq, before the first bomb ever fell on Afghanistan, we said, turn over Osama bin Laden. Turn him over. And the Afghans said, well, we're not so sure about turning you over to him, turning him over to you, but we will darn sure turn him over to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. They said that. They were willing to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And George Bush said, nope, not enough. Got to give him to me. And they said, well, we're just not going to do that. And that's when the bombs started falling.
Yeah. Well, we know what kind of little egotistical jerk he was. But you know what? The part I do agree on keeping Gitmo Bay or Guantanamo Bay prison open, it should be kept open for George Bush and his cronies.
Hear.
Yeah, I'm telling you that they need to get a taste of that damn barbed wire and chain link wire fence, and because they're as guilty as any person in there. They've killed more people than any of the people in there have, and created the situation. But I'll get on. So for someone else, there's groups that's the hate groups. Nazis and the Knights of Columbus and all these groups, they are putting out all these threats now. I don't know if you've heard it or not, and it made the news this evening. And they, you know, it's a kill type of thing. And my position on that is, you know, if there's anybody who deserves the White House, it is the African-American, because they built the damn thing now, didn't they?
Well, amen to that.
And the other thing, I want to tell you some good news, and then I got a question, and I'm going to get the heck off here. I got a response from Bob Byrd on Billy Wayne Bailey, and he's up that proverbial creek. He will not be. In fact, I think they've already appointed the person they're going to get. So the phone calls and everything that took place has been a success.
Okay.
The other thing is, what is going on? Why? What have they found out, or what are they browbeating Caroline, whatever her name is, Kennedy?
I only saw the very barest of information on that, but apparently it had something to do with her taxes.
Well, ain't that awful? As much stuff as the other people's done, and she, you know, I'd never in hell withdraw. I'd say, well, we can make that right. That ain't nothing we can't correct. And I, you know, because you know what kind of person she would be if she got in there.
I think so, yeah.
And the Republicans despise the very thing that she represents.
But I also don't know, but what, there might have been a family conversation too.
There's something more to it than just taxes, because very few of them, I think they found out something a lot deeper than that.
I don't necessarily know that it's more nefarious or more or worse, but I just think there may have been a family conversation that said, you know, you want, because the Kennedys have never risen to power more or less just through, you know, bang, you're there. They work their way up.
Yes, they did, but while they were working it up, they built their house on sand. You know, they were rum runners from the Caribbean all the way back to their dad, you know, to her great granddad.
And there is a long history of that in America. It might be worth noting that Alexander Hamilton was the son of the bastard son of a Caribbean plantation owner who was involved in the rum trade. And what's more, the man who was the president of the Continental Congress, John Hancock, the man who said, "I'll sign my name so large the King of England can read it without using his spectacles."
Mm-hmm.
He was a smuggler.
Yeah.
He helped finance a bunch of the revolution on smuggling.
Well, people ought to read the Rockefeller history, and you know the stuff they teach in history is a crop. You know, we know who Betsy Ross was, and we know this, and we know that. We know how coal was established, but we don't even know the people that's running this country. We don't know their history, Bob. If they did, they wouldn't be in there. And I don't, you know, you don't know how to get that across, because it's like we talked before. You can give a damn guy a six pack of beer and a ball game on the weekend, and everything is forgotten, and he don't ever watch or talk to anybody that knows anything. If he does, he'd follow George Bush over New River Gorge Bridge. We've been told that, and. When you got that mentality, the net results are George Bush or cronies that are like him. But getting off that subject, one real thing, I just wondered how you wanted to bet on Pittsburgh, and then I'm going to get off of here.
Oh, I'm taking the Steelers all the way.
Oh, man, you ain't giving me a chance.
I'm not good. No, I mean, I haven't seen the spread yet, frankly.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll take the other team in 10 without arguing.
Wait, you'll take Phoenix and give me points?
No, I said I'll take 10.
Oh, what?
I want Pittsburgh.
it's you know what? It's anything but for certain.
That's good. We've had a spate of decent Super Bowls. You know, we had that long string of Super Bowls not being worth watching.
Mm-hmm.
But we've had several dandies lately, and I think this one could be another good one. Especially, you know, that wide receiver for Arizona, Larry Fitzgerald, class act, sublime talent.
Yeah, all you have to do is throw the ball up in the air, and he seems to be there. I've watched.
You know, when he was at Pitt, I watched him wear the Mountaineers out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was like he was Spider-Man or something and could just, you know, shoot a web up and bring the ball down.
Yeah. And the quarterback ain't no slouch either.
No, he's been down this road before.
I don't think Rosenberg can compare with their quarterback. It is. You're right. It's going to be a good game.
It depends on how much protection Roethlisberger gets.
Yeah.
And, you know, his ability to improvise has really improved over the years. And, you know, I mean, that little touchdown pass last weekend was just, I couldn't believe it. He was on his way to the ground. He threw this wounded duck up. The guy came back and got it and took it all the way in. It was beautiful.
Those are flukes, though. And there won't be no flukes in this one, I don't believe.
Well, I got a prediction from the chat room that the Steelers are going to do it.
Yeah, well. That's the reason I want Steelers, you know.
I have a feeling they're going to be, I don't know how heavily favored, but I'd be surprised if it wasn't 10 points or so.
If they put 10 points, I would like to find out who's handling the cards now, because I would take the other team and I'd put 100 on it at least. I'd love to have the other team in 10 points.
Well, you know what? The other thing that may change the line is the health status of Hines Ward. You know, he went out in the first quarter this last game, and they got through it okay. But I tell you what, a Steelers without Hines Ward is a different Steelers team. There's no getting around that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that Iron Curtain, when it drops,
It drops hard. It drops real hard. Hey, Ed, good talking to you. I'm glad to be back, and we'll talk soon, okay?
Well, we're glad you're back, and we're glad you didn't get your breath taken leaving that runway over there.
No, we just sat there for a half an hour waiting for George Bush to get out of the airspace, so, yeah.
Oh, damn. Why did they wait?
Well, I know.
But anyway, tell your family we said hi.
Sure will.
Just really glad you're back.
And say hi to Dreamer for us, all right?
All right, sure will.
You take care, Ed.
All right, good night.
Good night. It's our buddy Ed here in Fayette County. And like I said, extra innings, and I'll go until the phone's clear. Just because, you know, like I said, I was gone 2 days, and these were 2 days that felt like 2 weeks. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how's it going?
Hey, Cossack, what's happening, man?
Not much. I was going to offer, if I ever get back up in that area again, I'll take you for a walk and tour of D.C. It'll blow your mind.
Oh, and that's the thing. I'm always hurrying in and hurrying out. And I want to do the touristy stuff. And you know something? The riding down, we were in one of those death-defying harrowing cab rides. And we were driving past the National Archives, and guy looked at me and he said, "Bob, this is something." He said, "You look over there." He said, "I have never, not in high summer when all the tourists come, never, ever seen what I'm looking at now." And there was a line coming out of the National Archives, Cossack, coming out of the building, out to the sidewalk, and all the way around the building, people wanting to get in and see the Constitution.
Damn, that's pretty good.
It says something about what people are expecting and what people want.
Yeah, I'd like to take you for a little walk up to Fort Stevens. Ever heard of the place?
No. Betraying my ignorance.
That's a Union fort that was built right off of Georgia Avenue. And it's the only time that... only time since Madison that a U.S. president's been in the line of fire.
Oh, is that where the "get down, you dumb son of a bitch" line comes from?
Yeah.
Where the Union soldier said that to Lincoln?
You know who the Union soldier was?
No.
A certain Union captain, Oliver Wendell Holmes.
Was it real? I had no idea.
Tackled him and and said, "Get down, you son of a bitch." turned around and said, "Well, at least I'm glad to see you know how to address the civilian."
Well, I knew the story. I didn't know who was behind it.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain or one of them.
No. Oliver Wendell Holmes.
Senior or junior?
Junior.
It must be before he developed his little cocaine fascination.
Correct.
Okay.
Before he became Justice of the Supreme Court, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Brilliant man, though.
Well, yeah. Son of a Boston Brahmin, the works.
One thing I wanted to point out to you, if you ever go to D.C., look for the little turret houses when you're going up the various main streets of D.C., especially towards the north. They kind of stick out a little bit, and they're usually circular or semicircular.
I saw one of those.
You know what that is?
No.
That was built with the idea that if Washington was ever besieged again, the army would take hold of those houses, and you would hold that entire neighborhood up to the next turret house.
I'll be darned. No, it's a fascinating place. It is an absolute, and you can't do it. You need a week for the Smithsonian alone.
Yeah, well, it takes a couple of weeks, or actually a good full summer to go street by street, neighborhood by neighborhood, because they're all so tremendously interconnected. They all have their own little histories.
Well, we were, Guy and I were not too far from DuPont Circle this time through, and what a great little neighborhood that is.
Oh, yeah. Well, you need to go there, and you also need to go to, my brain has locked up, don't worry about it.
Oh, you think yours has? Man, I am running on fumes.
Thomas Circle. You know who that Thomas is?
No.
Does the name George Path Thomas mean anything to you?
It should, but I am dumber than a post right now.
How about the Rock of Chickamauga?
Okay, sure. There you go.
Thomas.
Okay.
That Thomas. One of the very few Virginian generals in the Union Army, and a damn good one at that.
Well, Virginia was good at turning those out.
And Grant was on his way to dismiss him when he won the Battle of Nashville.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. Grant kept on yelling at him to attack Hood, attack Hood. And he couldn't. They kept on getting hit with ice storms every two or three days. And it was, you know what it's like after an ice storm. You don't go anywhere. And finally, when he moved, he destroyed what was left of Hood's army. What Hood didn't destroy at Franklin.
Yeah, true that.
God. Yeah, let's have 17 Pickett's charges in one day.
Oh, the Battle of Franklin was a nasty thing.
Oh.
And trying to remember. I'm thinking it might have been Shelby Foote. I know Shelby Foote wrote a brilliant novel, fictionalized account of Shiloh. I think he may have also done one on Franklin, too.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a novelized version of the Battle of Franklin that's absolutely breathtaking. Takes in the whole, march up from Columbia through Murfreesboro and all, Murfreesboro, isn't it? And you can drive. I've driven it 100 times, but I've driven it once. The U.S. highway that comes up from Columbia towards Spring Hill and on up north that way is right along the line of march.
And can you imagine what it must have been like for Tom Carter, the Confederate captain? That's his house up there.
Yeah.
Hasn't been there in 4 years. He gets there dead. He gets there. I mean, God. Yeah, that's the thing. People who don't get into the Civil War don't understand, just how wrenching that entire experience was. It was horrendous.
Yeah, it was.
And we don't understand. A lot of people don't anymore.
Well, it's hard to be a kid growing up in the South, and
And frankly, I think probably there's an area of the United States, you know, Pennsylvania, Maryland,
Virginia,
Ohio, Kentucky, and points south that have a deeper understanding of it than others do. But what, you know, the reason it matters is when you go to a place like Shiloh, and I was more familiar as a kid with the southern and western battlefields than I was with the stuff in Northern Virginia, but because of proximity. But you go there to a place like Shiloh, and you see the monuments that have been erected by Iowa, Illinois, Wisconsin. You know, Douglas MacArthur's daddy, wasn't it, or his granddaddy, was out of the Wisconsin militia or army.
Yep.
And
where he made his name, right?
Lookout Mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wisconsin.
Exactly. They're mass graves of, you know, farm boys who came, you know, just on the call of Abraham Lincoln, which incidentally was, you know, illegal, but never mind.
Yeah.
Constitutionally, presidents, and that's not some southern boy talking, that's a guy who's into the Constitution, presidents do not have the power to raise armies.
Right.
Or to declare war. Well, Lincoln did both. And threatened to imprison Chief Justice Taney if he said anything about it.
Well, as a Marylander, I can tell you Taney was an ass.
Well, sure he was. I mean, he's the father of the Dred Scott decision, is he not?
Correct.
Yeah.
And there was a Taney Junior High School where I grew up.
Well, you go and you read his decisions, and the guy was, you know, he was like another one of those experiments where, you know, if he wrote that thing in a forest, would he still, and nobody was there to read it, would he still be wrong?
Exactly.
Well, Cossack, I am going to run along because I am a whip puppy.
Alrighty, I'm glad to see you're back. I'm glad to hear you're back. No, we missed you.
And I've got more stories to tell. Just don't let me, because the stuff that actually happened inside the Progressive Media Summit was amazing in its own right. But I don't know that I'll be telling them tomorrow, because on Saturday morning, I'm a very busy boy these few days. On Saturday morning, I'm going up to, or actually Friday night, I'm going up to, tomorrow night, I'm going up to Flatwoods, West Virginia, and making sure that the gig rig all works the way it's supposed to. And then Saturday morning, we will be broadcasting the proceedings of the Progressive Democrats of West Virginia.
All right.
All day long. So I think, like, Sunday, I get a nap.
And you'll need it.
Oh, in a big way. And then I get a week, I get a little week's break, and then turn around and back to D.C. Driving this time, not flying.
Ah. Well, at least you'll be able to drive.
Well, I'm hoping that that's a good thing as far as the weather's concerned.
Yeah. Hopefully it'll clear up a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was getting toasty in D.C. even as I was leaving. So, you know, maybe we'll have some unseasonably warm weather. But, Cossack, good hearing from you, friend.
My pleasure.
And we'll talk soon, okay?
Yep, sir.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
You know, I got on that plane and didn't have nearly the annoying experience that I did going up this afternoon. I went up on Tuesday, came back this afternoon. But, you know, you come up off of the runway at Dulles, and it's all that flat Northern Virginia land, and it's pretty, and bank around, and pretty soon you see the Blue Ridge rising and those broad, beautiful valleys in between the mountain ranges, the Appalachians, home. And the minute I laid eyes on the first mountains coming into view, something happened in me. And in a way, I think I felt what the June bug feels when a little six-year-old boy's got a string on his leg and letting him fly around kind of like a kite. Because the minute I laid eyes on those mountains, I felt home pulling me like there was a string on my leg. I felt like the whole aircraft
was being pulled into the hills. And it was a sweet feeling to be coming home. And I will tell more about what happened at the Progressive Media Summit, because there is much more to talk about policy, about things that are perceived to matter. But I want you to know two things. I kept my promise. I kept my promise. As soon as there was a discussion on green energy and greening the economy, and I stood up, identified myself, and I asked a question. And I put it to Byron Dorgan of North Dakota. And I simply told them that for all the talk about green energy and sustainable energy, that I have great respect and hope for, that all of it may well be for naught if we don't end mountain removal in Appalachia. And I don't know if those senators, there were three or four of them in the room, I don't know if they had ever heard the simple fact that more high explosives are used on Appalachia than have been used in total against Iraq. I don't know if they knew that children are subjected to war zones right here in America. And I told them point blank that I told them, we know from what happened in Kingston, Tennessee, and the 1.06 billion gallons of toxic goo that was dumped on those folks, Appalachian people. I don't know. I think everybody in this room will now acknowledge that there is no such thing as clean coal. And we need you to acknowledge it, too. We need you to acknowledge that my children and Appalachian children all through the region deserve to grow up in an area that they're simply trying to live in will make them sick. Bad sick. And I told them, I'm not talking about ending coal mining to get altogether. I'm talking about ending mountain removal coal mining. Coal extraction, it's not mining. And I told them we need them to get on board with the Clean Water Protection Act, and the sooner the better. And Byron Dorgan looked at me and proceeded to tell the room, tell the assembled liberals and progressives in that room that they had coal to thank for 50% of the electricity in the United States. And I again said, I'm not talking about ending coal mining, I'm talking about ending mountain removal. It was unsatisfactory in the extreme. And then I sat, I was afraid I'd made an ass of myself. I wasn't trying to. But I made a promise that I would deliver a message. And I delivered on my promise. But then I waited throughout the rest of the proceedings. Guy asked a couple of beautiful questions related to media and progressive media, and continuing to grow the infrastructure that will allow us to fight back against the flush phlegm balls and the Hannity jobs. And I waited, and there was a lot of discussion about the various and sundry different policies and pieces of legislation. And you know how much we've talked about another particular piece of legislation. And I sat there for 3 hours. 3 very good hours. Took pictures, shot video.
I sat there for 3 hours waiting for somebody to mention the Employee Free Choice Act. No one, not a senator, and not a member of that audience, raised the issue. And so eventually, Harry Reid walked into the room to give us some remarks at the end of the event, and he talked about what he intended to do and what his plans were. And I finally stood up and I said, Senator, we've heard a lot about a lot of things, and a lot of things that we can all get together on and help you go forward on. But whether you're talking about a green economy, or whether you're talking about jobs, or whether you're talking about health care, there is no single piece of legislation you have before you that is more important than the Employee Free Choice Act. And he put his hands out to me. He says, wait, you don't need to go any further. And he said, I am a union man. And proceeded to tell us about his favorite Woody Guthrie song, Union Made, and said, there will be a card check agreement by summer. We'll talk some more about this at a later date, but let me just submit to you that knowing what we know about the makeup of the Senate, see, Employee Free Choice is not an issue in the House of Representatives. That thing will be passed by a monumental margin. It'll be huge. The only dissenting voices, you know, 100 or so of them, will be the weirdest of the weird right wing who despise the people who carry this nation on their backs. When it gets to the Senate, though, right now, Senator Reid, frankly, does not even have all the votes of his own party. So if he's going to pass that this summer, you and me, we, the people, have a boatload of work to do. And I just let you know that, to let you know that I came through. I didn't waste my time. I'm incredibly grateful to Guy James for inviting me along on this. It was absolutely magic. And we had a wonderful time. If you're friended up with me, you can go and look at a few photographs from the event on my page at Facebook. I friend freely if you're not already. I'll see about getting some of the photographs on the website as well if the indomitable Sue, ELO, has time here fairly soon. But I did want you to know that I take my responsibilities, the responsibilities that you give me, deadly in earnest. And I did my best by the lights I have to live up to your trust. And I will continue to do that with every trip. So thank you. I hated being away from the microphone, but if it, at the risk of it sounding silly or old-fashioned, though I left the microphone, I did not leave you. I took you with me, and you were there with me every step of the way. From the people battling for all of us who are all downwind and downstream, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. To each and every individual battling mountain removal, whether they do it by themselves or whether they do it as a part of a group, I took you with me and held you in my heart. And the same thing goes for the Employee Free Choice Act. I understand there's a stimulus package. Lots of people were fascinated with it, wanted to know where the money's going to go. A lot of talk about health care. Among the single most important issues that we face at this time.
brilliant remarks on health care from Oregon Senator Ron Wyden. Seemed like a real decent Joe. Sherrod Brown of Ohio had some great health care comments. All of this was vital and important. And as I said, Debbie Stabenow understands, gets the need for liberal, progressive media and having the message out there and having the dialogue and the discussion and the conversation. I am convinced that she absolutely gets it, and she really gets it. But those two, what I feel about the people who are fighting to save this community, the counties, states in Appalachia, cannot be measured. Because they're fighting a fight that involves the future of my children and grandchildren. And I've told you before, and I will tell you now, they are heroes to me. The bravest, hardest working people I know. And the same for labor. I don't belong to a union. I don't have a union health care plan. I don't have a union pension. But I sit here behind this microphone and I speak to you because my dad, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, uncles, cousins were union men. But most especially, my dad was a union man. And God only knows what would have happened to me had he not been. And I owe that debt. Labor owes me no debt. But I damn sure owe that debt to labor. And I carry that in my heart. And to the extent that I have the ability, I use my mind and my mouth to carry the message. Thanks, everyone, especially those of you who hung around for extra innings. As I remind you, probably won't be on the air tomorrow night. Be on the road to Flatwoods, West Virginia. Tune in pretty much all day Saturday. Everything, assuming that all the infrastructure works in Flatwoods, all day Saturday we will be broadcasting the proceedings of the Progressive Democrats of West Virginia. And I hope you'll join us. Not sure exactly what the format's going to be. It's a mystery. And I'll find out when I get there. But hopefully we'll be able to make your thoughts known as well. Thanks to John Fox for his part in hosting the inaugural party in the chat room. Thanks to ELO, Sue, for her part as well. Thanks to our forum moderator and chat room moderator, Lottie. Thanks to our news ninjas, Susan and Gene. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to all of you who, via your ideas, your calls, your emails, and your financial contributions, make the horn what it is, and perhaps even more importantly, what it can and will be. Thank you all. If you have not become a contributor to the horn and you have the ability to do so, the PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com works just fine, and we do appreciate it. If you prefer snail mail, that's on the website as well. It's and I can tell you, it's Head On 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB, Personal Mail Box 318, Beckley, Beckley, West Virginia, 25801. So now I am, off to sleep. And no matter how much fun you have wherever it is you go, we all know that you never sleep as well as you sleep in your very own bed. So that's kind of where I'm headed. Thanks, everybody. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.